will call to order the Senate Committee on the Environment and Natural Resources. It is 2 p.m. on the 21st. Is it the 21st? It's the 21st of September. We have a large agenda of informational items today. It's all going to be invited testimony and questions from members of the committee. And we're going to do our best, despite starting a few minutes late because the last committee ran long, to catch up and stay on schedule because there are other things happening after 5 o'clock. I know our Senate Democrats have a caucus meeting. I don't know if the Republicans have a caucus meeting or not. So real briefly, we're going to do just short of an hour on an overview of carbon offsets. We're going to hear from the Climate Trust on that. We're going to have an update on the bottle bill. That's going to be 30 minutes maximum. The presenters, I think, have been instructed how long that their presentation should be, and we're allowing for time for questions from the committee. Then we're going to have a report from the task force on the Department of Fish and Wildlife funding task force, and then a report from the task force on independent scientific review for natural resources, an update on Cleaner Air Oregon, and an update from the diesel work group. So the first hour almost is going to be dedicated to carbon offsets. So with that, Sheldon Zakreski, director of carbon compliance for the Climate Trust, could you start out? And the reason we're having this, we're going to spend a little bit of time in advance of next legislative session, is that, of course, if the legislature elects to take a cap and trade, cap and invest type approach to carbon regulation, one critical component of both the California model, the Ontario model, the Quebec model, and what could become the Oregon model is our offsets. And there are a lot of different feelings about offsets. And I think a lot of people see opportunity in offsets. And there are environmental justice communities that have concerns about offsets and are stakeholders for whom environmental justice issues are particularly important. And I think that there is a lack of understanding about just how offsets work and the offset markets work. So I've invited Sheldon to come and at least give us a base of understanding for the committee from which we can work forward. So with that, Sheldon, the floor is yours.
All right. Thank you, Senator Edwards. And I'd like to thank the committee for giving me this opportunity to speak to you today about carbon offsets. So for my presentation today, I thought I would just start out with a brief slide to just give you a little bit of a background on the Climate Trust, just to sort of give you sort of the context and our perspective on carbon offsets. And, you know, in sort of thinking about offsets in a policy framework, you know, there's been, you've kind of got carbon taxes on one hand or cap and trade on the other. And, you know, with taxes, there has been some discussion that, you know, it's conceivable you could throw offsets in there. But, you know, to date, sort of how cap and trade has worked under theory and practice, offsets have kind of come under cap and trade. So I thought I would just have one brief slide to kind of define, you know, what we're talking about when we say cap and trade. And then going to talk a little bit about, so what exactly is the role of, you know, offsets under this sort of broader cap and trade policy. And then kind of get a little specific into what are some of the design criteria around an offset, what sort of gives an offset its kind of environmental rigor and credibility. And then sort of before I share some closing thoughts, just kind of talk a little bit about more about kind of how they're, you know, created and sort of what sort of transparency and different checks and balances that kind of go into creating and transacting an offset. So the Climate Trust got its start almost 20 years ago, and it was a result of a act of legislation with the state of Oregon. So it's we actually kind of came about as part of the energy facility siting process. And basically any fossil-fired plant that wants to get an energy facility siting certificate has a carbon dioxide mitigation requirement. And one of the ways with which they can comply with that requirement is what's known as the monetary pathway. And under the monetary pathway, that's basically where, in order to comply with that requirement, they're paying a qualified organization, which is the Climate Trust. And then it becomes our responsibility to take these carbon mitigation funds and to kind of go out and find offsets. So we've been doing this, like I said, for about 20 years, you know, and started before a lot of the infrastructure that exists today started. So we've kind of got a lot of, you know, experience in seeing not only how these projects design, how to design these projects, but how they perform over, you know, 10, 15 year period at this point. We sort of leveraged this role through the CO2 standard to implement about several acquisition programs nationwide. And, you know, to date, we've kind of taken in about $50 million in carbon acquisition funds, and we've managed about 45 different offset projects across the country.
How, Sheldon, really
yes.
quickly, and I invite committee members to ask questions as we go. Feel free to tell us if you're going to get to that later.
Okay.
So, so you said 50 million. Mm-hmm. How much per ton?
Okay.
Is like what's the rate?
So let me see here. We've committed about $32 million to date, and the latest report on we don't sort of disclose all that information, but we do have to give a 5-year report to the Energy Facility Siting Council. And so going back from our first investment, which was 2001, up through the end of 2014, I think our average portfolio for the Oregon program is about just short of $5 a ton for offset.
Mm-hmm.
You know, from a climate perspective, you know, one of the things about, you know, offsets or any emission reduction is, you know, again, from the climate, it doesn't really matter where in the world it's coming from, you know, and it can really happen anywhere, and it's going to have sort of the same scientific effect. But, you know, we do realize that, you know, there's a lot of ancillary benefits associated with these projects, and it is important to, you know, think about what can be done locally. And here's just kind of a sampling of some of the projects we've invested in over the years using funds from our Oregon program or from a voluntary program we manage with Smart Energy. Most of our investments as of late have kind of been in dairy digesters, which I'll describe a little bit more, and forestry. And, you know, another component about this with our offset investments through this Oregon CO2 standard, you know, we're pretty proud to, like, you know, represent that 55 cents of every dollar we've committed through this Oregon standard is going towards projects in Oregon. So I thought it'd just be helpful to kind of, you know, provide just like a very basic overview of what cap and trade is, you know, and to, you know, there's a lot of talk about carbon prices. And so to contrast with a carbon tax, you know, carbon tax is what we'd call sort of a price-based mechanism. You're essentially putting a price on carbon, but you're not putting a cap on emissions. And, you know, as you can see, one of the challenges with sort of doing that is emissions can theoretically rise. We're actually seeing that in British Columbia recently, you know, and I think a lot of that is the function of that. They've sort of set their they've set their carbon tax price, but it hasn't been updated in several years. So the last 2 years of data are sort of showing an upward in emissions in British Columbia. Cap and trade, by contrast, you know, the cap kind of comes in. You're putting a quantity limit on the amount of emissions in the regulated sectors in your economy. And You know, cap and trade, you can sort of you can design the scope in different ways. It could be fairly narrow or industry specific. In the Northeast, there are 10 states that have a cap and trade program that covers only the electric utility sector. And then you can also go broad, and that's the case in California, where their cap and trade program, they're capping 80% of their economy. And so the trade part with cap and trade kind of comes in where when you sort of establish these this emission ceiling, you're kind of establishing kind of a, you know, a ceiling or a kind of a compliance budget to your regulated entities, and you're distributing allowances to them, and these allowances have an economic value. And so the thinking is that by giving these allowances an economic value, it starts to provide that much more of an incentive for regulated facilities to take kind of direct on-site emission reductions, because one of the things is that it kind of helps them to pay for the costs, because if you implement one of these emission reduction measures, in theory, you should have excess allowances that can then be traded, and they can be traded to a company that, for one reason or other, you know, doesn't have the, you know, the ability, or is not economically feasible for them to try to take a, you know, emission, emission reduction measure. And then the last thing I wanted to say about cap and trade is reference to my sort of dated 15-year-old joke is it actually didn't start with Al Gore. It's been around a lot longer with that. Cap and trade actually, it came into play in practice first in the late 70s. It was actually used to help phase out leaded gasoline. It didn't start out that way, but one of the challenges in the complete phase out of leaded gasoline was it started to become extremely expensive and cost prohibitive. And so towards like the end of the lead phase out regulation, they'd sort of implemented a cap and trade program to kind of help complete that phase out. And then another example of cap and trade in action is in the late 80s, early 90s. It was used to help control acid rain in the Midwest and Northeast. So basically it was designed with the electric power industry in mind and to try to control their sulfur dioxide emissions. And not only did it sort of achieve the desirable reductions, but an interesting thing was that it achieved those desirable reductions at a fraction of the cost of even what moderate cost estimates were saying the program was going to cost. So, you know, it's proven to be, you know, not only environmentally effective, but economically efficient as well. So to kind of talk a little bit about how offsets fit in a cap and trade program. So when you're talking about putting a cap on greenhouse gas emissions in your economy, it's not really possible to try to do that economy-wide. You can't really, you know, regulate a biological process such as, you know, the growth of a forest which absorbs carbon dioxide, or the decay of that forest which will result in the release. You know, there's really no way that you're going to be able to have a cap that would cover 100% of the sources. And so, you know, the theory is that offsets can kind of come in as a project-based emission reduction activity from an uncapped sector. So those sort of sources of emission reductions that would sort of fall outside of the regulation. You know, the reasons why you'd want to have offsets in here is they can be a very important cost containment mechanism. And they can actually fulfill that role, you know, in spite of them maybe only being a small percentage. So, for example, in California, there's an 8% limit on the usage of offsets. But they trade at about 20 to 30% cheaper than a carbon allowance. And so they've actually, you know, proven to, you know, have some value for companies that have a compliance target in that they could use these offsets to help meet their compliance goals at a sort of a bit of a cost savings. Another thing about offsets is they represent a bridge. You know, when we kind of think about climate change, you know, we're really at the start of trying to put a price on carbon. You know, and a lot of where, you know, we're trying to deal with the sort of, you know, mitigate catastrophic climate change, you know, we're looking out decades in advance. And so, you know, one of the things about offsets is really helpful is they're kind of providing a bridge, you know, where you can sort of come in and impose a price on carbon, but impose a price on carbon in a way that doesn't create a lot of excess and undue volatility in the economy. So you can kind of think of them as having a bit of a moderating effect. Yeah, please, yeah, Senator Dunbar.
Sheldon, why do they trade cheaper than allowances? What is it about them that's causing that?
They trade cheaper than there's. I mean, in the theory, why offsets trade cheaper than allowances is because they're sort of, you know, coming out of a project-based emission, and it kind of has to do with a lot of the different climate science and the protocols that kind of get in and how you account for it. And so there's always going to be a little of uncertainty or risk as to whether the volume you're forecasting will actually materialize. Whereas with an allowance, you know, that's sort of certified legal tender. So you can kind of think about it as, you know, different currencies. You know, you can, like, I'm Canadian, so it's like how a Canadian dollar trades at a discount to the U.S. dollar.
In going a little bit deeper on that, so mm-hmm. Are you going to get into how many protocols there are?
I can talk a little bit about
if you
protocols.
Because I guess that what you just said leaves me a little bit unsure about. You said it sounds, by what you said, I took that to mean that there's uncertainty about the amount of carbon mitigation, and there's going to be an end of project certification that is going to look at that and mm-hmm. at that offset project, and then determine how much carbon was in fact mitigated. Or
yeah, that's definitely part of it, and I'll sort of get into that sort of process on
okay,
how
so
that works.
So there is some sort of clawback then, if to ensure the integrity of the of the offset.
Yeah, definitely.
Okay.
So let's see, where was that? Another point I wanted to make about offsets is, you know, you definitely hear a lot about are you buying your way out of pollution by using offsets? And I mean, I would sort of argue that that's not actually the case. I know that's definitely the perception, but if you look at a lot of any of the studies that have been kind of done on it, whether it's a voluntary company or a company facing a compliance commitment, those companies that rely on offsets, they generally have stricter emission reduction targets than those who don't. And just to sort of point, like a source of data, there was a report that came out recently by an organization called the Ecosystem Marketplace. And what they do every year is they look at data from the Carbon Disclosure Project. The Carbon Disclosure Project is a sort of nonprofit where businesses throughout the company, they sort of submit their kind of annual carbon inventories and sustainability reports to. So they're sort of designed to provide a lot of information for investors to kind of evaluate what are climate-related risks that could affect the bottom line of these companies. And so using that Carbon Disclosure Project data, it was generally found that companies that invest in offsets, you know, they typically do that as kind of like the last thing they go to. You know, if you kind of think about it, a lot of times you want to take care of your own house first and do your own sort of emission reduction measures in-house before you start to look kind of outside at these different project-based reductions and bring them into your carbon budget. And then the last thing I wanted to say on the slide before I kind of talk a little bit about some specific project types is offsets can actually be a very important rural economic development tool. The way the offset market has sort of shifted, a lot of these offset project types, you're going to find them being located in rural parts of the country. And just to kind of give you an example of the project types the Climate Trust focuses on, this is not all the offset project types that could be available in their compliance regime, but the types that we are sort of looking at that we kind of feel have a high level of rigor and demand in the marketplace would be avoided grasslands conversion, where you're preventing the conversion of grasslands to farming of crops. And we're actually looking at a project in Wallala County right now with this. I've mentioned forestry. We recently did a forestry deal last year with the city of Astoria involving their forestry watershed. And then dairy digesters. And, you know, dairy digesters have kind of, they're technology designed to kind of manage the manure in a more climate-friendly way and to create a renewable energy source. And we've covered projects in Junction City, Boardman, you know, Tillamook. So we're not going to the Pearl District in Portland to look for these projects. So I'm kind of talking a little bit about the design criteria, you know, the sort of theory on what makes a, you know, offset kind of credible and, you know, has some rigor towards it. The Climate Trust worked with a group called the Offset Quality Initiative, and it was us and several other nonprofits, and we were pretty active about 10 or 8 years ago. That was sort of a period where there's definitely a lot of interest in cap and trade in state legislatures and federally as well. And so we kind of came up with these, you know, 9 criteria of what, you know, you should look for in an offset. And I'm gonna focus on kind of a few of these that I think are important. But before I kind of get into that, and also sort of addressing this issue of what's an offset, you know, give some tangibility to it, I do want to kind of clarify that there is definitely a difference between offsets and renewable energy credits. You know, if you think about the two in the context of cap and trade, you know, again, offsets are kind of coming from an uncapped sector. They're outside the cap. But if you've got a cap on the electric generating sector, one of the ways an electric generator can comply with their, you know, carbon compliance target is they can, you know, procure or generate more renewable electricity. And what that's going to do is that's going to actually generate more allowances for them. So when I talk about offsets, I just want folks to sort of know, you know, the act of sort of wind power or solar power, that's not something that we would, you know, would ever be considered a, you know, a sort of offset under a cap and trade program.
This is a time check showing you're just over a third way. So you
okay? I think I've got about 4 or 5 more slides to go, and then I'll hand it over to you for questions. So probably the biggest one, and this is maybe something a lot of folks, if you've dived into offsets a little bit, have heard about, is this term called additionality, and it's generally called business as usual. And a lot of times you sort of see the theory when folks talk about offsets. It's like, so do you basically mean that there's going to be enough money coming to the project as a result of the offset that would make it business as usual? And, you know, that's sort of known as financial additionality. And that is one way to look at it, but it's a very extremely difficult thing to prove. So it's not something that's really been adopted widely in practice. And to give you an idea of why that is, let's say we were looking at a biogas project that is generating electricity. And we've seen examples of these projects come online 7, 8 years ago, and they got a very attractive power purchase price. But a few years later, if they didn't do a long-term contract, those power purchase prices came down because there's just been a lot of natural gas come on, and electricity prices sort of came down. So you could see an example of where a project in the planning stages might not look financially additional, but after a couple of years, it could be highly financially additional. So that's kind of why, you know, where a lot of the sort of shift in the focus on how you design, you know, offsets and kind of, you know, try to find a way in the design stage to where you can sort of determine whether or not they've got some rigor and then, you know, not have to focus a lot on the design criteria once the project moves into the operational stage is sort of the three lower bullet points. The first one is a very basic test, and it's definitely a must-have. And so regulatory surplus just means you want to make sure the project is happening voluntarily, and it's not a result of a mandate. A brief example of that is there are mandates at landfills to basically collect and combust methane. And the reason why that mandate's in place is because if you don't, the landfill's going to explode. And so there's a safety reason driving that regulation. An ancillary benefit of that is greenhouse gas emission reductions. So, you know, there wouldn't be a credible offset to sort of say, okay, I'm combusting my landfill methane, give me an offset, because they have to do it anyway. So that's a pretty basic thing. A thing that a lot of folks focus on, you know, in determining additionality is this common practice threshold. How many people are doing it? And so with that, I'll kind of turn your focus to the picture there. That's actually a picture of the lagoon at Lockmead Dairy in Junction City, just outside of Eugene. So if you go to a dairy anywhere in the United States, 99% of them manage their dairy cow manure by putting it into a lagoon. And by doing it that way, what kind of happens if you walk up to one of these things, you'll sort of see bubbles. And those bubbles is like, that's actually methane being vented out of the lagoon. And, you know, methane's a pretty powerful greenhouse gas. It's about global warming potential of 25 times greater than carbon dioxide. So if you change the manure management system from a lagoon to a dairy digester, you're basically diverting it into a technology that allows you to capture that methane and create a biogas, which can then be combusted. You can put it in the pipeline. You can combust it to produce renewable energy. You can just burn it. And that process has a benefit for the climate because you're converting it to CO2. And so, you know, common practice is sort of something like dairy digesters, where it's a type of technology that has a climate benefit that less than 1% of the farms are using today. And then sort of the last, you know, thing that, you know, a lot of these sort of offset protocols will look at are kind of like a barriers test. Are there financial barriers? And, you know, example I can kind of give of that is if you're looking at forestry, you know, looking at the project we did in Astoria, the way the financial barrier worked there was they looked at their sort of updated their forest management plan and realized that they could harvest a lot more timber than they had been and still maintain the safety of their watershed. And so they kind of had the choice to either increase their harvest or to maintain it, and they can generate a carbon payment from that. And so that's where our kind of carbon payment came in. You know, there was actually there's a financial barrier there. You know, why would a cash-strapped city give up, you know, timber revenues? But there was like, you know, we were able to sort of close that gap with carbon enough that balancing it by taking a lower revenue by not harvesting that, providing more insurance for their water quality, it sort of worked for a win-win. So that's kind of a example how offsets, you know, the barriers test can sort of demonstrate offset additionality. The other design thing I wanted to kind of call out is this sort of, you know, we don't want offsets to do any kind of net harm. You know, the motivating factor for an offset project is to reduce greenhouse gas emissions, but we want to be make sure that that project doesn't create, it doesn't result in sort of a, you know, direct cost that has some sort of other environmental negative. And I could, you know, maybe to sort of give you an example of what that might look like. Let's just say there is an offset, there's a project type that wants to become an offset project, and it, while it reduces emissions, the emissions reduction technology or process would result in like a significant increase of water in an area where, you know, there isn't a lot of water, and, you know, it may result in the processed water being kind of tainted water. You know, that's the type of trade-off we don't want to see with offset projects happening, where you're generating a climate benefit but at a cost to water quantity and quality. So Senator Edwards kind of mentioned protocols, and I kind of talked about three in, you know, the, just to sort of divert into, you know, California, the ones that are active there are projects like sort of rice harvesting. There's improved forest management. There's avoided conversion. There's dairy digesters, and coal mine methane are sort of the current suite of available offset projects in the California system. And one of the commonalities of these sort of different offset project protocols, and where I was talking a little bit about where there might be a kind of, you know, discount in pricing, is somebody needs to kind of come in and verify the emission reductions. And so you have an offset project operator who has implemented their project, and they're kind of, you know, keeping their data and they're sort of tracking everything. But we don't want to just sort of trust, you know, their own kind of numbers are right and that they get to kind of say this is how many offsets we've produced. And so we want to make sure there's a qualified third-party auditor that can kind of come in. And, you know, how I kind of like to best sort of explain, you know, in addition to kind of qualified and objective, is the verifier gets paid a fixed fee. So if it's going to cost $10,000 to do an audit of the project, that verifier is going to get $10,000, whether it's 50 offsets or 50,000 offsets. So for one of my final slides is, wanted to kind of talk a little bit about offset project registries. And so these are kind of third-party standards. And you know, it would have been nice to have them around when the Climate Trust started in 2001. Most of these sort of three standards, they kind of came online within the last 10 years. And, you know, the reason why I'd say it'd be nice is they provide a very valuable service, because these are sort of the folks that kind of provide that roadmap for how do you evaluate whether a project is additional. How do you come up with your carbon accounting, you know, estimate and kind of quantify what the emission reductions will likely look like? how do you maintain and monitor your data to make sure that a verifier can review it and sign off on it? And, you know, they can play a very valuable role in a, you know, cap and trade system, because they can sort of be a source that they can be these sort of, you know, offset experts and sort of deal with a lot of those, you know, maybe tricky issues about, you know, is this project additional, you know, is it being verified correctly? And they sort of play this role in the California system. So if somebody is kind of has a project in the California cap and trade system, you know, they'll kind of put it on one of these three offset project registries. And then they'll hire a verifier, and the verifier will kind of review the project. They'll issue their verification report. And then one of these three registries will actually check that verification report and kind of issue a number of offset credits. And then if you want to convert those offset credits into credits to go into the California system, they've kind of chosen a path where their regulator, the Air Resources Board, will review that work. So I'm not suggesting that that's an essential of cap and trade. That's just a model that California's chosen. But, you know, it's important to sort of show that, you know, there's obviously guidance on how you monitor it. There's a first line of defense and a check with a verifier. There's a second check and a line of defense with one of these offset project registries. And in the case of California, there's a third check. So, you know, offsets, by the time they actually get issued, at least in the California context, they've gone through several checks, and they've been, you know, highly vetted and verified before, you know, they've actually kind of become materialized and kind of ready to trade. So I guess just for, you know, kind of my wrap-up here before I open it up for questions, I guess the things I want to kind of emphasize about, you know, offsets in a, you know, cap and trade program are that, you know, they can definitely be a valuable source of cost containment. And I think that's, you know, important, you know, to kind of balance between bringing on a carbon price and making sure that price doesn't cause a lot of volatility to the, you know, economy. They represent a bridge towards kind of larger scale technologies that could be installed in the source, such as scrubbing CO2 could come online, and that they can, you know, represent a source of rural economic development. So with that, I'm happy to take any questions you have about offsets.
I have some questions. Yeah.
How does an offset control volatility in the market when it actually increases the prices of everything?
Could you repeat that?
How does an offset control the volatility in the market when it will actually increase the cost of everything?
I'm not sure how an offset would increase the cost of everything, because under the context of a cap and trade system, the kind of you know, price that you're using is sort of a, you know, what's being sent as the signal, as the cost of the emission reduction is the allowance price. And so it can help to kind of, you know, control volatility by preventing that allowance price from increasing too fast too soon by providing another source of, you know, fungible credits that can kind of come in and, you know, help to moderate those price increases.
Follow up?
Yeah.
Is an offset an increase of the price? Does an offset increase the price of someone's producing CO2?
No. I mean, a regulation, a cap and trade program would.
They have to purchase the offset, correct?
Yes, they do.
So the underlying regulation that caps greenhouse gas emissions, and, you know, you could either, as you know, and, you know, you're putting him on the spot. You can put me on the spot. And I would argue, I'm a fan of offsets. I've been, you know, pretty clear about that, because I think that they help mitigate potential cost increases. So does that mean that it now costs less to comply than, you know, than without the regulation? No, it's going to cost more. It will cost to comply. Not trying to say it's not going to, but it's going to cost less than if you don't have offsets. So.
Mm-hmm. Price point.
Right.
Thank you, Chair Edwards. First, I thank you for the conversation. Mm-hmm. That's your explanation of offsets and allowances are more clear than I've heard before, so I appreciate that.
Thank you.
But Oregon produces like 0.04% of the global greenhouse gas emissions. Complete depopulation of the state wouldn't change that. It wouldn't be measurable. Absolutely wouldn't be measurable. So what is the purpose of applying these cap and trade or offsets or whatever to Oregonians when a complete cessation of using any form of energy wouldn't be measurable? Is it political, or is it or some demonstration of leadership to others? Is it for lack of a better term, is it the creation of a new regulatory agency? I mean, what is the purpose if we're not going to make a measurable reduction in greenhouse gas emissions on a global scale or even on the West Coast scale?
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know if you've seen the last edition of the National Geographic, but it chronicles the emissions coming out of China.
Mm-hmm.
Wouldn't it be better to channel your efforts toward the emerging industrial nations that are actually causing the problem and moving forward in that manner? Now, you may not have you may not have the authority to do that, but why would we be doing this in Oregon where we don't where it won't make a difference, whereas it this effort could be expended somewhere where it actually could make a difference?
Okay. Thanks for that question. So at the last kind of international climate change conference that was sort of held in Paris, you know, there was definitely a lot of report about an agreement about amongst, you know, many countries to try to bring about a change to, like, you know, help lower, you know, emissions by about to the point where we could lower temperatures, you know, by about 2 degrees to stave off catastrophic climate change. And when you look at the countries that kind of signed on to that part of the Paris Accord, 88 out of 196 have text in there saying that they're going to use market mechanisms. So, you know, we're talking about, you know, probably even though it's less than half of the countries, we're talking about some pretty substantial countries. And that's more than, you know, so I'd probably argue that more than half of the global economy have sort of signaled a commitment towards doing that. China, as an example, China has, they have cap and trade programs. They've actually leapfrogged us. There's been, you know, some state-level programs. And when I'm talking about state-level, I'm talking, you know, multi-million population states. So there's about several cap-and-trade programs that have kind of just recently gotten off the ground. To kind of get to your question of why Oregon should do that, you know, you're right. Oregon is a very, say, small part of the greenhouse gas emission reduction pie, but I guess there's a choice to be made where do you want to, you know, get into what's sort of becoming a burgeoning market and a growing market that's sort of heading to the trends of where, you know, you could maybe see going out a global market now when the price of carbon could be set at around $10 or $15, provide an opportunity for sectors in Oregon that are outside of the cap to get know-how. Or do you want to wait to where some of these other jurisdictions have kind of come in and set up systems that, you know, could take offsets out of Oregon and then try to come into a market at a much higher price? So, you know, I guess maybe to answer your question, there's advantages to acting now.
It's my understanding that the United States does not have a congressionally mandated carbon cap and trade program or any other carbon control program. Is that correct?
I mean, there's definitely not a mandated cap and trade program.
Good. Do you actually believe that countries such as Russia and China and India are going to pay people in the United States or in Oregon for offsets and allowances for their pollution?
Someday, yes. I mean, I believe that where we need to go as a way to help tackle this problem is a market-based approach. You know, it's we kind of stray off into areas of science, which isn't my expertise. I've got an economics background, and, you know, one of the things that I guess I've sort of seen, you know, in my background is a very effective and efficient way to deal with, you know, environmental problems is through these market mechanisms.
And one follow-up, you believe that...
And Senator, if we could keep sure. And you are. I mean, you're focusing on offsets, but I know you just want to go after climate policy generally and just rip into it. And, you know, and that's a policy, you know, thing that we will decide as a legislature. Sheldon's been kind enough to, as a financier. I mean, you're basically a financier.
Sure. But I work in offsets, so I have colorful conversations.
I've invited him to come explain.
I appreciate his explanation. His explanation was the clearest I've heard. So I'll have to go with that. Thank you.
Senator Denver.
Thanks. So my good colleague to my right, I think, has raised questions from a perspective from the right. And now I want to express some concerns from the left.
Sure thing.
And that is... you know, and the chair really suggested this earlier on, that is, people who are concerned with social justice and environmental justice particularly mm-hmm. have concerns that the use of offsets will allow polluting sources to continue to pollute mm-hmm. and buy their way out of compliance. You know, where you might have a cement factory, for example, which is both compromising global health, but also public health mm-hmm. of the neighbors who live there. I just recently heard critiques along those lines, and I didn't really know how to respond to them. So how do you respond to that charge that particularly for people who are, you know, for vulnerable populations that are living in areas where there's a lot of pollution,
mm-hmm.
How does a cap-and-trade regime address their concerns, and particularly when offsets are involved?
Sure. Well,
and perhaps, Sheldon, you could to change the question just a little bit. Maybe you could use an example from an industry that's not energy-intensive, trade-exposed, such as cement, because we've directed in the legislation last session, which didn't mm-hmm. pass, but we passed out of this committee, as amended, the department was directed to consider leakage in energy-intensive, trade-exposed industries, and you know, grant, I can't remember the language, but a waiver, essentially, mm-hmm. to energy-intensive, trade-exposed industries to address leakage because, you know, it's just going to go somewhere else, that production. But there are other examples.
Right, but I just will say that for those who are living in the neighborhood of those, that exclusion just exacerbates the problem.
And that has nothing to do with offsets.
Right.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And in Oregon, there's one cement plant in the middle of, well, I won't say nowhere, but it's a fairly rural place. And I happen to know that they appreciate the jobs there. So
sure. I guess my response to that is I know there's definitely a very strong environmental justice community. We've seen that in California, where, you know, they have definitely a different structure where they have facilities in these sort of low income, you know, minority neighborhoods. I'm not sure how that might play out here in Oregon, because it definitely depends on the geographical location of these facilities. But, I mean, to get to sort of your question on how I would respond about the role of offsets is, you know, one of the ways with which you can design, you know, offsets as part of a policy is you can limit their use. You know, again, in the case of California, it's 8%. You know, that's a pretty strong signal that they have to, through a cap and trade program, you know, use allowances and sort of, you know, try to directly reduce emissions at of the source. And one of the other things I guess I'm going to say it about offsets is, again, as a cost containment mechanism, there are some benefits to allowing the usage of these instruments in here, because low-income people also pay a disproportionate share of their income on energy costs. And, you know, to be real about it, it's not a situation of, hey, industry pays or consumers pay. It's going to be some sort of shared responsibility. And so, you know, by allowing some measure of offsets in, you know, again, it's going to help, you know, moderate the price and maybe help sort of tamp down on some of these spikes. And I know this isn't part of offsets, but one of the nice things about a cap and trade program is if you takes the step to actually auction off the allowances, you're generating a source of revenue. And if you look at what they've done in California, a lot of their auction revenue is being directed back into, you know, low-income communities.
Could you touch briefly? So you went over the 8 protocols in California, 8 of them. But then there is a world of offsets that are outside of compliance offsets, the voluntary offsets.
Yeah.
So where do those, like the Grasslands Project in the Dakotas,
mm-hmm.
financed by Chevrolet?
Yes, that's correct.
So that's not a compliance offset, but it is an offset. So
mm-hmm.
Give us a brief comparison of the compliance world and versus the voluntary offset world.
Sure. I guess the thing I'd probably want to start off and kind of talking about the, you know, the voluntary offset world, that's kind of like a bit of your laboratory or your testing ground. So one of the things California did when they decided to select the compliance offset protocols that they did was they sort of looked at what's kind of the level of uptake and experience in the voluntary market. So Senator Edwards brought up Grasslands. You know, that's something the Climate Trust is pursuing, and we are pursuing it through the voluntary market, and that's because we sort of feel like, you know, taking it through the voluntary market where it can kind of go through the protocol, have a third-party verifier, have it verified, facilitate some of these transactions, such as like we did with Chevrolet, it provides that good testing ground so that, you know, those types of voluntary protocols can be, you know, looked at by the compliance market and brought into the compliance market, because there's a, you know, a level of surety there that, hey, these things are well understood and that, you know, we know that they can produce a certain amount of offsets that could play a valuable role. Because I think one of the things you don't want to see in the compliance market is having a lot of the time and effort spent on bringing in an offset protocol, but not having that offset protocol be used by anybody. So we look a lot at the you know, voluntary space is sort of this laboratory space. And where a lot of the focus is in the voluntary market these days with offset protocols domestically is on agriculture. So I brought up Grasslands. Another thing that we're sort of tracking is nutrient management. And this is something that California is also looking at well, where you can sort of optimize your fertilizer management practices, and that has a greenhouse gas benefit to it. So, you know, to kind of contrast, I guess, the voluntary offset market, it's pretty wide open in terms of the ability of bringing protocols in as long as they pass those sort of criteria, and it's a great place to use as sort of a testing ground for adoption of protocols to come into a compliance system.
So the compliance, and it seems to me, while California and Air Resources Board officials, I believe, in California have said in order for another state or province to link with them, there has to be as much stringency. And I don't know if that's the right mm-hmm. word, but I think it, personally, I believe that there's an open question as to whether or not other states could adopt other protocols as compliance,
mm-hmm.
Compliance protocols, and still link with that larger California, Quebec, Ontario market.
Yeah, I mean, the sort of subnational jurisdictions, you know, they do have that ability to adopt their own protocols and create linkages. I know for a fact in California made a decision to not allow landfill gas projects. You know, I know in spite of my earlier example, there are examples of landfills out there where there is no regulation to, you know, collect the methane and combust it. And so California made a policy decision not to include landfill gas methane destruction protocol in their system, but Quebec did make the decision to allow that type of protocol in their system, and there's still an allowance of, you know, for the linkage between those two economies and systems.
Just a question on that. Is that because California requires them to capture the methane? Is that why it can't count for this?
Yeah, that's correct. I mean, there's other examples of, you know, that's one of them where every landfill in California has a capture requirement. Composting is another one. We've actually done a couple of organic waste composting projects. And, you know, that's another example of, like, we thought would be a really great protocol. It works pretty well in the voluntary market, but California didn't adopt it because they've got pretty strict waste aversion mandates on the books. And so they're kind of choosing to take a different, you know, regulatory route to with waste aversion as a way to mitigate greenhouse gases as opposed to using a composting protocol. So.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Do any states or other entities have requirements that the offsets be come from projects within their jurisdictions? I mean, you had mentioned that almost 50% of those being used in Oregon are Oregon, mainly rural projects. Mm-hmm. Can one put a fixed amount on, a requirement such as that?
I know in the case of California, they're national. I know Washington just adopted a regulation which is kind of talking about limiting the creation of offset projects to Washington State. I know that raises some concerns about, you know, whether or not you're violating the is it the sort of intertrade commerce clause. So there's definitely that risk. And also, I wouldn't, you know, it's not something that's probably good cap and trade policy to try to limit, say, offsets to a, you know, particular state, because that's going to kind of undercut a lot of their, you know, main role, which is that kind of, you know, cost containment approach. But, you know, in terms of maybe, you know, mandating a scope, I mean, I think, you know, domestically, you know, is definitely a, you know, probably a good place to start if you're concerned about, say, offsets coming from international sources.
And we did, I spent a little bit of time looking into that, this and this particular question in the interim, and it, if you look at, and that's why one of the reasons I'm interested in the question about whether linkage is possible if you adopt your own compliance protocols, because, you know, we don't grow rice in Oregon.
Yeah.
And, you know, rice fields is one of the compliance mechanisms. And it, you know, kind of serves a dual purpose in California because they grow a lot of rice. So maybe there are some offset protocol potentials for that make more sense for Oregon that are both greenhouse gas mitigation efforts, but also help Oregon projects. So, and you know, we don't without going into all the protocols, but you kind of go down a list of the protocols and see which ones you kind of, there's obvious low-hanging fruit and which there's not. And I think that's why dairy is kind of the most used protocol in Oregon, I think, to my knowledge anyway. So,
yeah, I think that's right.
Other questions for Sheldon? All right. Thank you for the overview of offsets and for being here with us today, and we will transition to our next presenter. Thanks.
It's my pleasure. Thank you.
So up next, we are going to have an update on the bottle bill. I believe that we have Paul Romaine, Renee Niedermeyer, and Peter Spendalo to present. If it's a different group, just let me know. We'll be flexible. So.
I flipped a coin with my daughter, and you lost. You get it. You won.
So we have 30 minutes allotted on our tight agenda for this discussion. I think we want to allow time for questions from members of the committee. So, in other words, the three of you should not take 30 minutes in total for your presentations. You should allow for questions along the way. So, and whoever wants to start.
Mr. Chair, I just have one question. Since I was we were listed twice with my daughter, do I get 10 minutes or do I just?
Absolutely not. And the reason we're having it, for anybody that's interested or cares, the reason we're having this update is because there have been some triggers in the law, and we have some changes upcoming in April, and the deposit's going to go up to 10 cents. I think constituents are going to be, they'll probably be somewhat knowledgeable and perhaps a bit surprised and have different feelings about that. So I want to start educating the legislature as to how we got here. So, and what's going to happen.
Okay. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Paul Romaine. I'm with the Romaine Group, and we represent the Oregon Beer and Wine Distributors Association. The person who really should be here is out of town today. That's John Anderson. He does the Oregon Beverage Recycling Co-op. But since I've been around since this thing was created, I sort of felt I could give a little bit of history on it. And I did have a lot to do with the creation of OBRC and its predecessors. So, as you all know, the bottle bill was created in the 71 legislative session and went into effect in 72. And it was really based upon a concept of exclusive territories, because the products that it covered were pretty much distributed in exclusive territories. So that which you sold into the marketplace, generally speaking, if you were if that was your territory, no matter where the person took their container back to, you were probably going to pick it up. So the nickel always found its home. The redemption rate through my tenure with the beer and wine distributors has been up in the high 90s. Some people were over 100% for a while in redemption. But what we found through the years is that one of the bigger issues that came up was how the product was collected. It was a very inefficient way to deliver and collect product. Basically, what you had to do is figure out if with a beer truck, you were going to have so much product coming back, and you had to space out your truck so that you couldn't have a full truck going out. To remedy that, what happened was some people in the Portland area and then around the state started getting into cooperatives where they would, in effect, have an entity, their co-op, that would go out and collect the product, leaving the distributor free to just sell the product, make it a little more efficient. But in effect, you were setting up a separate company. When the bottle bill was expanded in 2007, that really led to the absolute necessity to have some kind of cooperative around the state to actually get product back, because you were bringing in product, water, that was not distributed in exclusive territories. It was very difficult to figure out where the product was, who had the deposit, so you needed a central collection point. So OBRC was created, and it's been an incredible success for the state. Basically, our return rates have been diminishing over the years because of the value of the nickel and, frankly, curbside and other things like that. Basically, you have 2,400 convenience stores that take about 14% of the returns. About 200 large grocers account for about 43% of the returns. And really what we've done now, the OBRC has created, it says 16 on your sheet, but it's really 17 bottle redemption centers, which collect 45% of the returns. And the goal is to expand that up to, I believe it's about 47 redemption centers around the state. In addition to those, because the goal is to get most of the product to come back through those redemption centers. In addition, should I dance or should I?
I don't know. I feel like I need to stand and salute or something. Like.
Where was I? In addition, what OBRC is doing in the rural areas of the state, because these redemption centers really don't are not economic in rural areas of the state, is they're putting in, trying to put in 85 different green bag drop centers. What that means is you will take that bag that you get, put your container in there, drop it. You have a coded card, and in effect, the next day you are credited, your account is credited with the value of that which you returned. So it's a way to make this easy for everybody around the state, not just in the local metropolitan areas. In addition, right now they were building out four per year. Their goal this next year, the board of OBRC has stated that they're going to try and build out eight per year now, push the redemption. The costs right now, last year, the year-end operating budget was $27 million. There's about $25 million in unredeemed deposits. So it's close to a wash. One of the big fears that you have with this, in addition, the bottle drop costs, the cost to actually put these things in and increase pace of the rollout increases the cost per unit. So it makes it more difficult. One of the things that we're concerned about is, with the increased deposit, where will that redemption rate go? Because the unredeemed, in effect, this is your near-perfect system. It's those who don't want to comply with the bottle bill are paying for those who do comply with the bottle bill. It's a wonderful system. It's self-contained. There's no government money involved in it.
Well, it's wonderful as long as you're not curbside. I'm one of the I recycle. I'm just non-compliant with the bottle bill. I'm helping finance.
Yes, and we thank you very much for that.
The build out of those.
But what you may find out is that there are gleaners who go around your neighborhood and pick up your containers and actually bring them in, because some of those are actually being collected.
Yeah, I agree, in a lot of particularly urban settings.
Right.
Not in my neighborhood, but...
Also, in addition to the costs of the bottle bill that are with OBRC, you have to understand that existing distributors still pick up from all the bars and restaurants. We still have that obligation. What OBRC picks up from are the premise sales. I'm trying to not go through too much of the stuff that's in your written testimony that was sent to you. Is that the phone again? Oh, well. The deposit's going up to 10 cents. There is one state that has a 10-cent deposit, and their redemption rate is up in the mid-90s. Now, if the redemption rate goes up to the mid-90s, that's actually going to create somewhat of a financial problem for us, because there will not be a lot of unredeemed money out there to use to finance this thing. So what we're hoping, in effect, if you have a 70% redemption rate, in other words, 30% at a nickel, and you move it up to 85, you get an increased redemption rate, but there's still the same amount of money there to operate the system. So that would be somewhat of an ideal situation. What the bottom line here is, what we tried to do as a distributor community throughout the years, we didn't ask for this bottle bill. We were the biggest opponents of the bottle bill when it came in. And we complained for 10 years, just complained. And then we sat down and said, all right, this is stupid to complain. It's not going away. How do you make it work? What's the system that will actually make it work? And we have probably the best bottle bill system in the country, except for the fact that the redemption rate's going down. And we believe that's probably a function, a little bit of curbside, because we believe that there's not that much that goes into curbside that doesn't get redeemed. But the value of that nickel is not the same as it was back in 1972. So by pushing it to a dime, we're not opposed to that. We did not advocate for that. We thought we could hold the redemption rate with the centers that we were building out at a higher percentage. We were unable to do so, so we are obligated. In addition, you know that the bottle bill will be expanding, not only going to 10 cents in April of next year, but also different containers are coming in. There's another 200 million units per year that we believe will be coming in. So that's going to present some logistical issues. April 1 presents a difficult issue for us because for those of you who are familiar with labeling products, it's not that you can say, all right, everything that is sold March 31 has a 5-cent container stamp on it, and you get 5 cents or pay 5 cents, and then the next day nothing with 5 cents can be sold, it has to be 10 cents. So we've been working with the Liquor Control Commission, and they've been very flexible on this to allow us to at least have some leeway. The bottom line is every container bought or redeemed prior to April 1 will be a nickel, either deposit collected or deposit paid out. Every container, no matter what the label says, beginning April 1, will be 10 cents collected, 10 cents redeemed. So is there going to be a large number of redemptions in April? You bet there will be. Are there going to be people basically hoarding stuff for a month or two or whatever? Yes. Will there be an increased cross-border traffic? Yes. I don't know how many of you remember the Seinfeld episode with Kramer and Newman. Newman took his the mail trucks, and the joke was, we're going to take the New York containers, which also have Michigan 10 cents on them. We're going to pay 5 cents for them here. We're going to take them to Michigan, and we're going to collect 10 cents for them. And everybody laughed about that episode, except for beverage distributors, because that was truly what was going on. We expect more containers to come across. We've tried to put in place measures to combat that, but it's near impossible. I will tell you, a few years ago, one of the soft drink companies actually did a separate UPC label, which is expensive to do, just to monitor, not to deny, but just to monitor. And what they found is that 40% of their particular product coming back to Janssen Beach was from Washington State. So it's a big issue. Again, it's difficult. You're not going to station guards at the border to protect us against containers coming across. It's something we will deal with. It's a cost of the business. How much of a cost will it be? We don't know. Will there be deposit money that will be available for us to build out? We're hoping. We're looking forward to it being there. We're anxious to build out the entire system. It makes it easier on everybody, more convenient for everybody. But I'll come back in another 5 years and tell you whether it's working. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. Let's go next.
I'm next. Renee, for the record, Chair Edwards and committee members, Renee Niedermeyer. I'm from the OLCC, Director of Government Relations and Communications. And what I'm going to do today is just talk about OLCC's responsibility under the bottle bill and a little bit about that transition from 5 cents to 10 cents. Oops. There we go. So our responsibilities really are threefold. We have the initially we have the responsibility to investigate, basically approve the applications for the redemption centers. So we work very closely with folks to do that. Once a redemption center is approved, we provide notice to other dealers within the redemption zone that they either need to participate or provide equivalent services. And we also provide exemptions for those dealers who sell fewer than 100,000 beverage containers. The second thing we do is our compliance with statutory requirements. We have responsibility to make sure that the labels have the correct refund value on them, that dealers accept the containers and pay the refund, that distributors accept containers from dealers and pay the refund value. And the third thing is that we receive the annual beverage container return data from distributors and then calculate the statewide redemption rate.
Mr. Chair?
Yeah.
You said you receive the redemption rate from the distributors. Do they also give you the sales rate?
Yes, they do. So House Bill 3145 in 2011 basically inserted language into the law that said starting in January 1, 2016, if the number of beverage containers for two consecutive years redeemed is less than 80%, then that hits the trigger, and the refund value goes from 5 cents to 10 cents. On the latter of 8 months after the determination, or January 1st of the following year. The commission received the redemption data in late July of this year. On August 1st, they determined that the redemption rate was 80% for the last two consecutive years, as Paul testified. The redemption rate has fallen somewhat. It was 68.26% in 2014. Now it's 64%. Which triggered the rise in redemptions from 5 to 10 cents in April of 2017. I thought that it might be helpful to talk just a little bit about what's going to happen in 2018, because we're just in the midst of really getting started and what we're going to have to do for that change in law, that trigger. It requires, in 2018, deposits on all beverage containers on the same items that are contained today. It exempts deposits. So distilled liquor, wine, dairy, and plant-based milk and infant formulas are exempt from the bottle bill. But the additional products that are added in 2018 are included. Basically, what the law says, it's everything else is included. And then it cites some examples: tea, coffee, hard cider, fruit juice, kombucha, coconut water. It also sets some sizes. So currently, water, soft drinks, and beer, the redemption rate applies to containers that are 3 liters or less in size. The new containers that are coming on in 2018, the redemption rate is required from 4 ounces to 1.5 liters in size.
Can I ask a question, Mr. Chair?
Yes.
And maybe you'll get to this, but I'm curious about the effect of the new containers, what the new the effect will be on redemption rates. You know, something that we saw that helped to drive down the redemption rates under the existing system was when we added water bottles. And initially, I don't know where we are on that, but initially the redemption rates were pretty low on water bottles and tended to bring everything down. I don't know if that's still the case or if our water rates have gone up to where aluminum and glass are, or is there a concern that we're going to see everything go back down again?
Senator Dembro, that certainly is a possibility as new folks get used to redeeming these new products, and we'll just have to see what actually happens on the ground when it goes into place.
Now, if I could follow up, how are we doing with water now? Has that improved?
I don't have the specific numbers on the breakout on water itself, but I can certainly get that for you. I'll get that for you.
Thanks.
Okay. So there are a few implementation challenges as we go forward, and Paul alluded to a couple. One of them in particular, the labeling. The first thing for us just as an agency is, how do we communicate with folks? How do you know our stakeholders? We don't necessarily have everybody's email addresses, or we need to communicate with manufacturers, both the in-state and out-of-state and international. We've got the public, we have the grocers, we have the convenience stores, we have the distributors, and I can say right up front, the OBRC has been a really great partner with us in getting the word out. That's been very helpful to us. But as we've talked to manufacturers in particular, they brought up a whole lot of issues: the lead time for changing labels or ordering labels and getting them actually affixed to the product. The issue of having stored products, and the law actually says that every single can or bottle needs to be individually labeled. So does that require the breaking apart of the pack and relabeling? And then just the issue, a recent one that just came up of folks that were planning on doing a new product introduction in mid-March, and what do they do with the label, right? So there's some of those issues. So you know, what I think has happened is we've have good awareness that the rate's going up. Timing has become an issue for us, and because the statute requires individual products to be properly labeled. But the reality is on April 1st, there's not going to be a magic switch and all products are going to be taken off the shelf and new products are going to be put in. That's physically impossible to do. And what our intention was at the commission was that we would initiate some temporary rulemaking to help give some certainty to folks on what this transition could look like and as much as possible, you know, give some clarity and to be able to answer their questions. And what we found out is we actually don't have that rulemaking authority. And the other issues, as just we go forward, there's compliance and enforcement issues, and we have one staff person who's been allocated, who we have budget for the bottle bill. They start in April of this year. So I just briefly wanted to talk about the rulemaking authority issue. In statute, so the OLCC for both alcohol and marijuana has general rulemaking authority to implement the statutes. We don't have that authority for the bottle bill, but what we do have is some limited rulemaking authority. So we do have, we can create exemptions for containers that are included in the 2018, the new products that are coming in. I'm not saying that we would create an exemption for this, but one example is diabetic drinks or something. You know, we'd have to go through a whole rulemaking process to see if any other items would be exempt from that bill. We can set standards for the establishment and administration of the redemption centers, but we don't have any discretion to set standards for non-participating dealers. And again, we already talked about the labeling issue. We don't have the ability to set a grace period and set out some guidelines for manufacturers as they move forward to comply.
Mr. Chair?
Yeah.
So what are you going to do?
That's my next slide.
Oh, cool.
I'm trying as much as possible. So what we can do is communicate, and work with people as much as possible. Very first thing we had to do right off the bat, really, is just get our own staff on board so they understand what's going on when they get questions from the public, that they can respond appropriately. We've reached out to the recycling and redemption centers. OBRC, as I mentioned before, has been really helpful. We sent out a letter even prior, it was in March of last year, to distributors and manufacturers, as many as we could find, that warned them that this was coming. We didn't know for sure, but that our commission would be making a decision, and it was likely that the labels, the redemption center would, redemption rate would rise. We have outreach to our consumers, we've had outreach to our media, and then of course our own licensees, so we have some ability. We don't have the greatest email ability, but we send out notices of renewal, so we can send it out there. We have a dedicated bottle bill section on our website. We have frequently asked questions, a bottle bill fact sheet, redemption center maps, and we have developed a whole slew of downloadable content for retailers, which includes posters, signage, shelf tags, information sheets, a QR code, and clerk handouts. We have a bottle bill listserv and earned media and a dedicated bottle bill email for questions. And this is just an example of one of the handouts that we have available. And in an answer to your question, what are we going to do? Our intention is really to work with people to get as compliant as possible on April 1st. Recognizing that it's going to take some time, and we're going to work on education first and enforcement later.
Mr. Chair?
Yeah.
Are you planning on giving, say, a six-month leeway for that product that's on the shelf and doesn't turn over quickly? Are you going to allow them a length of time to do that, to get new product into the store eventually so they can sell through? Or are you limited and can't do that?
We can't officially do that. Because we don't have the rulemaking authority to do that. But what we can do is focus on the education. And our intention really is we're, when we work to educate folks, that we're saying try as hard as possible to get it done on April 1st, but we're really expecting you to have those properly labeled by the end of the year.
Could I answer this, Paul Romaine?
Yeah, briefly.
Very briefly. We've been working with the Liquor Control Commission now for a little bit of time on this very issue because it scares us, basically. And what we found is their staff has been extremely flexible in trying to make this work. And the one thing I can pledge to you is we will make this work. We've made it work for 44 years. We're going to make it work. It's going to be – there'll be a few glitches – and you're going to get a story here and there about somebody doing this or doing that. But the bottom line is we will transition into making it work and with the help of the regulator. And that's all we can do.
Senator Woodson.
Yeah, I have several questions for Paul just quickly. have you calculated the potential financial impact to the distributors of collecting a 5-cent deposit and returning a 10-cent redemption?
Mr. Chair, Senator Whitsitt, I have not done that personally. I know OBRC is concerned about that, and there is going to be a net, obviously, a pretty substantial chunk of change that will be going out.
How many million bottles do you handle a month?
OBRC would have to answer that. I'm not really qualified to tell you, but it's going to be a substantial amount. It depends. We think two things. One is people collecting 5-cent ones and redeeming them. That's going to be a hit in the beginning. And then again, the 10-cent is going to bring a lot of cross-border traffic in. So we think that will be another hit. That's something we're just going to have to live with. We're going to have to adjust, and hopefully we'll be able to have the finances to be able to make it work.
So does Michigan have the redemption centers?
No.
When were the Oregon's first redemption centers online?
Mr. Chair, Senator Whitsitt, I believe the first redemption center came in around 2009, 2010, right in there. I think it was out in the Gresham.
Was Wood Village
area. It was a small, we didn't know how this was going to work, and it was a very small facility, which has been outgrown. The redemption centers have been fantastic.
So my point, I guess, is we're seeing the percentage of redemptions going down.
Yes.
As more redemption centers get online, which is a troubling, we're going from 70.9 to 68.2 to 64.5. It's 16 is down another 4%. I mean, I don't know, but I mean, we're seeing the wrong trend there, and you're talking about a 5%, a 5-cent increase, going from 5 to 10 cents sounds really good. But in a 1970 cent, according to your graph, it would require a 30-cent deposit to really correct that. So, why do you think you're going to improve to a really higher percentage?
Mr. Chair, Senator Whitsitt, first of all, the addition of redemption centers, we believe, has actually increased redemption. We think it would have gone down further had you not had redemption centers, because the experience
increased the decrease.
It's basically mitigated the decrease. We think a lot of the decrease is, frankly, due to both the nickel being not as valuable to people and the fact that you have curbside, and maybe some people will throw some things in there, like the chair.
I'm not taking up the room in my garage to store bottles. That's what irritates me about this. But I support the bottle bill, and I like the expansion. I like the changes.
Yeah. But again, as I've said before, we are going to do the best we can to make sure that we get more bottles and cans and all types of containers back. Will it be sufficient? I will let you know in 5 years. That's basically all I can say. We didn't set up the system. We have set up the system to deal with the system, and we think we've been reasonably successful in the past, and we'll continue to do so.
We need to move on to Peter's presentation. Sorry, you are getting more and more compressed.
Yes, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'll try very brief, and I will skip over most of my presentation because you've already heard a lot of it. I just wanted to talk briefly about why we have a bottle bill, why it's important. When it originally passed, 45 years ago, we had a bottle bill for 45 years. We've had a 5 cent. It's only been 5 cents for 45 years. It was originally a litter bill. If you look at this picture, you can see a recent picture in Tennessee of all the beverage containers that have, accumulated there. You see a picture there of sort of a publicity picture we had in Oregon where comparing Oregon and Washington roads. I know myself because we did when I was a graduate student, I did a litter study comparing Oregon and Washington, and we did find that the littering rate of beverage containers is about four times higher in Washington than it was in Oregon back around 1979 or so. And that still continues. But the real reason, I think, now that's really important about the bottle bill is the impact on recycling. And just a very brief word on recycling. The importance of recycling is not keeping stuff out of the landfill. The importance of recycling is providing good, high-quality materials that industries can use as a raw feedstock to make new materials. And that's one place where the bottle bill really shines, because the materials that they collect are really good, high-quality materials. You don't have, for instance, as you have in curbside program, where people will put Pyrex bowls or they'll put coffee cups or things like that in with the glass, causing all sorts of problems to the glass processors. Nobody takes a coffee cup and tries to put in a reverse vending machine or takes it back to redemption center. High quality materials. The aluminum is really high quality. The plastic is really high quality. We've had, because of the bottle bill, we've had a plant form here in Oregon to simply take plastic and process it. We would not have that plant up in St. Helens if it weren't for the bottle bill. And so it produces really good high quality materials. You don't have some of the problems with curbside where you have stuff being lost in the sorting. A fair amount of the plastic does not make it into, it ends up in a paper mill instead of in plastic, because it simply gets missed when they're doing the sorting. It gets flattened. It acts like paper through the machines, and they lose some of that. They lose a bunch of aluminum. If you look at the rates of redemption, of recycling in deposit states there on the left versus the non-deposit states, you can see significantly higher recycling rates. So we're getting a lot more material out of bottle bill states as a whole than we are out of non-bottle bill states. And that's certainly true in Oregon, that our rate for soft drink is far higher under the bottle bill. The amount, we have not done a recent study, but the amount we found back in 2005 was only about 5% of the beverage containers were going back through the curbside programs. Most of them were being redeemed for deposit. Whether it was the household doing it or the scavenger doing it, we don't know, but they were definitely coming back. The last thing I wanted to say is that, again, the nickel really has changed over time. We do a statewide waste composition study, and we found back in 92, 95, that somewhere on the order of maybe about 5 to 7% of the beverage containers were ending up in landfills back then. When we did in 2005, it was 17%. So 17% of the beverage containers were not making it, they were being disposed. We suspect it's going to be higher now because, again, the nickel that was worth 5 cents back in 1971, according to price, consumer price index, would be at 31 cents now. So I'll end there so we have time, because I know we've gone way over. But if you have any questions about recycling and the importance of it, I'd certainly be happy to answer those.
Questions? Yeah. Senator Przanski.
Well, probably a question for you. The nickel, if I remember correctly, started previously at the distributor, and it goes in the first person that's paying that is the retail outlet that's receiving the material?
Mr. Chair, Senator Przanski, in various stages of the bottle bill, it started at different places, but basically in Oregon, it started, the first place the nickel was collected was when it was sold from whoever was selling it, either the manufacturer or the distributor, to the retailer. The retailer pays it. The retailer is always made whole because the consumer then pays the retailer. Any consumer that brings the nickel or the bottle back is made whole because they get the nickel, and then the distributor basically has the rest of that money and now uses it for basically building out a redemption system.
Okay. As you know, over the years, we've had a lot of concerns about the sheep money as to what's happening. I understand now under the model, it's actually being used to reinvest into it. do we have data? Is there stuff that I can have from my constituents to show how that's playing out? Because there was a letter to the editor in the Register Guard, I'm going to say in the last 2 weeks, probably further back, 2 weeks or so, where the person was complaining that this was just another means where the distributors were basically going to be getting more and more money by us going to 10 cents. And, you know, it's a unique argument. And I just, if I get these type of questions coming to me, I'd like to be able to direct them to information as to what is actually happening on the ground.
Mr. Chair, Senator Przanski, I think the best person to talk with, I would refer you to the OBRC, John Anderson, who knows this stuff very well. But the bottom line there is, if the deposit went to 10 cents and the redemption rate stayed at 65%, yes, there would be more money available there. But the whole purpose of it going to 10 cents is to try and increase the redemption rate up. And if it does as we expect it to do, like in Michigan, and it pushes it up considerably, then our big concern is, are we going to actually have less money to build out the system than we have today? So that's an interesting question, but it's one you John can give you stuff to basically tell a constituent. But 5-6 years from now is when we should have the discussion. You should have it with my daughter because I won't be here. Over what?
You said that 5 years ago.
But over what?
And I thought that. I thought that about myself when I was voting for it. I'll never have to deal with increasing to a dime. I'm going to be out of here anyway.
Yeah, anyway, the bottom line is we don't know. We're gonna work this as best we can. Real quick story. In the early days, Michigan actually had suggested that we, the bottle bill states, go to the federal government and ask for an exemption from taxes on deposit money, saying that they're not really our money. We pay taxes on that. When we collect that nickel, that's income to us. When we put it out, it's expensed. So we treat that just like income. We never went with Michigan, and Michigan dropped their effort, which we think was a stupid effort. But
one last question, if I can. Yeah. So regarding this issue of cross-state bottles and stuff coming in,
yeah,
I was under the impression, based on how things are now working, that the coating itself can actually keep a Washingtonian, someone from Idaho or California, from coming in with their materials and redeem here.
Mr. Chair, Senator Przanski, if there were separate UPC codes on these containers, yes, you could. You could have a separate Oregon, but that's a very expensive proposition.
Just ask.
And that, especially for the smaller people, that's impossible. There was one large soda company that did it as a test, and again, as I alluded to before, found that 40% in Jansen Beach was from Washington State.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you each for coming and giving us an update on what's going to be happening this coming spring while we're in the middle of session. And we'll be having a difficult time, having a hearing in April.
April 1st. Notice the date.
Yeah. All right. Next, we're moving to a report from Mark Labhart, the chair of the ODF&W Department of Fish and Wildlife Funding Task Force. You want to ODF&W? Do you want to join or not? Okay. So I sit on this task force. Senator Whitsitt sits on this task force. We did not have a vote. We were simply there for, I guess, kind of advisory.
Yes, you are.
In an advisory capacity. I think we've lent a lot of advice, most of which wasn't
very
heated.
Very beneficial advice.
Here we go. Some of which was heated. He's the chair, so anything that he says, don't beat up on him. He's just one guy. He's just the messenger. He's a very good messenger, really nice guy. And
I'm done.
Yeah, here we go.
Good.
Thank you, Senator. Members, again, for the record, Mark Labhart, chair of the committee. I'm going to take about 15 minutes. Is that
perfect?
Okay. And then move into questions. Three key preliminary recommendations that are, this is kind of the soundbite, if you will, to fully implement ODFMW's broad statutory mission. The funding need is approximately $80 million per biennium. Establishment of an Oregon Conservation Fund. And we looked at about 100 options, narrowed it down to two that we believe are the most viable, an Oregon income tax surcharge and a beverage container surcharge. And we'll talk about that those in details shortly. So the task force was established by you, the legislature, in 2015. The members were appointed by the governor as part of a legislative package related to funding for ODFMW. It was supported by fishing and hunting groups. It passed in the House 58-0 and the Senate 24-4. There's a wide variety of groups that were represented in support of it: hunting, fishing, conservation groups, outdoor recreation, tourism industry, so on. The four non-voting members, as Senator Whitsitt just said, Senator Edwards just said, Senator Edwards, Senator Whitsitt, Representative Helm, and Representative Krieger were on the committee. And so we did value and appreciate their input, and we asked for it every month. We've been meeting monthly since January, 9 months. I have two ex officio members, Chair Finley, Chair of the Commission, and Director Melcher. 17 members were appointed by the governor. Just to give you a kind of a, it was an interesting group because it's not your normal players. Columbia Sportswear, Leupold and Stevens, Nature Conservancy, Oregon Bicycle Racing Association, rancher from Eastern Oregon, a fly fishing person, Multnomah County Health Department, Travel Lane County, Oregon Trawl Commission. And you can see that it's a wide variety of folks that help participate. So our charge is threefold. Identify and recommend potential alternative and sustainable funding sources for ODFMW for the long term. Recommend any adjustments necessary to ensure that relevant programs and areas are funded in accordance with the direction that you gave in the bill. And third is to recommend opportunities to better achieve the mission through leveraging, coordinating, and budgeting funds from alternate and existing sources. So how did we go about doing that? First of all, when you try to balance fish and wildlife with human needs, there's a lot of things that are changing, as we all know. Population growth in Oregon is on the increase. A lot of new development in areas that are frequented by fish and wildlife. Drought, climate change, ocean acidification, many other things are putting lots of pressure on Oregon's fish and wildlife and the wild places that we all cherish. There's an increasing disconnection, mainly with children, from the natural world, affecting health, well-being, future of fish and wildlife. I don't see a kid anymore, more than 6 years old, that doesn't have a cell phone in his hand. He's got his head down into it. Conservation funded primarily through fishing and hunting licenses. That's what most of the agency's budget comes from. It's a financing model that was established many years ago in the 1930s. Funding approach is not sufficient to address the contemporary future demographics, resource demands, changing ecological landscape, and the new ideas and requirements that you as a legislature put on the department and ask that that be funded by fishing and hunting licenses. Comprehensive and sustainable fish and wildlife management conservation funding is critical to the livability of Oregon now and in the future. There's difficult decisions now, and they're only going to be more difficult in the future if we don't address this problem in this either upcoming legislative session or with some other method in future legislative session. So we can't keep doing it the old ways of putting it on the backs of hunters and fishers. ODFMW is the only state agency that has a fish and wildlife conservation mission. The conservation aspects of its mission have not historically been adequately funded. We need to ensure that the health of Oregon's ecosystems and native species through proactive approaches intended to avoid problems before they become ESA listings. It becomes an ESA listing, it's very, very difficult to reverse that course. Need to improve the education and outreach engagement of the public in support of healthy fish and wildlife populations and engage diverse and underserved communities, particularly in urban areas. Opportunity with expanded conservation efforts to ensure that hunting and fishing opportunities are there for all of us. So we had a process So again, we worked every month for the last 9 months. We figured that there's 22 members of the task force. Spent about 100 hours or about 2,000 hours of volunteer time meeting monthly. This little book right here is the compilation of what we worked on. So there's a lot of work that went into this book. We talked to other states. We researched some successful efforts in other states that established a conservation funding. We contracted a survey. I'll talk a little bit about that in a minute. We evaluated 100 different options, like I mentioned. We developed objectives, funding options, outcomes and measures, potential programs and adjustments. We engaged revenue and legislative council. We met with interest groups to get their feedback. Just a few of the ones we met with reps from the League of Oregon Cities, Association of Oregon Counties, 9 reps from the Outdoor Recreation Community Groups, 14 reps from the Conservation Organizations, Land Trust Alliance, Oregon Cattlemen's Association, I'm meeting with them on Friday, Fish and Wildlife Commission, Oregon Restaurant and Lodging Association, Travel Oregon, the ODF&W External Budget Advisory Committee, 10 representatives from the Center for Diversity and Environment, 12 representatives from the outdoor sporting groups, Northwest Sport Fishing Association, and I've probably left out some. Now, I can't tell you that they all endorse what we're proposing, but we did want to go and talk to them. We wanted to get their counsel and advice. We wanted to listen to what they had to say. Are we on the right track? Are we moving in the right direction? And so we got really good input from all of those groups, I believe. So the public opinion survey was conducted. It was a statistically valid survey of 900 Oregonians. It confirms that the high value placed on conservation of the state's fish and wildlife recreation and outdoor recreation, 95% confidence level. It revealed that a significant disconnect of these values and the public's understanding of how ODF&W operates and the funding challenges the agency faces. There's a satisfaction with the ODF&W management of fish and wildlife, 60% satisfied, 12% dissatisfied. Availability of fish and wildlife-related recreation opportunities, 47% said it was good, excellent, 34% said it was good. So you got almost 70, 40 and 30, 60, almost 70%. Credibility of the agency is good, 88% said it's a credible agency. The website was credible with a good source of information. There's a perceived funding. When we asked them, how do you think the agency's funded? 53% said it's funded by state taxes. 30% thought licenses, which is not right. ODF, we asked them, how should it be funded? 33% said it should be funded by taxes and 19% by licenses. Participation in outdoor recreation is most constrained.
Yes, before we go much further, those two points, I looked at those in the material. So that second one about how ODFW should be funded, this is the response from the public, and I guess I'm trying to figure out what the difference is, how we got 33% said that should be state general fund dollars, and then 19% said licensees should be paying it, or are they saying this is a split of how it should be balanced between general fund money and I want to say licensee money?
Well, we just asked them, and I don't know the exact question, and correct, Director Melcher's back here, he can correct me, but we asked them, how do you think the agency ought to be funded? And they said, well, the state ought to fund 33% of it, and then the users, i.e. fishing and hunting licenses, ought to fund that. So that's where the 19% came from.
All right.
Okay. Does it make sense, sir?
Well, what it doesn't make sense to me is I don't see 100% added up to some point. I mean, it seems like where's the rest of the
other sources, grants, federal funds.
But that's what the public was saying.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Funding needed. The task force asked the agency to develop a list of proposals that we asked them to say, give us what you think the funding amount should be. Expansion of conservation efforts, 46 point, thank you, Senator. approved hunting and fishing, sustaining existing conservation programs is $15.3 million. These are all biennial figures. Connecting Oregonians with outdoors, $8.3 million. deferred maintenance 9.6. I want to just elaborate a little bit on deferred maintenance. That figure came, thank you very much, that figure came from a 2005 report that the agency did. And the task force is going to be recommending a more thorough assessment of the deferred maintenance to be developed in the first biennium following, hopefully, the implementation of the conservation effort. So that deferred maintenance has still got some significant work to do. So we're going to be making some recommendations there, and we're trying to address Senator Witz's concerns regarding that. Recommended funding, about $80 million per biennium, fully implementing the mission and deferred maintenance. It's a 17% increase in positions. It's a 20% increase in the current budget, and it can be scalable depending on what direction that the legislature gives us. This is just some of the funding options that we looked at. We threw everything at the wall. I remember I said it was 100. This was just some of them.
Yeah, so, I mean, this is where the rubber really meets the road for the legislature. I mean, and you know, I mean, there are other aspects of it as well, but I want everybody to just absorb that list for just a moment before he moves on. You know, read it so you understand what was considered.
Is this in any particular priority of
order? No, it's not, sir. But this is only the partial list too. We looked at actually 100, but these are the ones that we spent some time on. But if this was easy, we'd have figured it out a long time ago, or you would have figured it out a long time ago. So. Okay, so
yeah,
yes, sir.
I just studied that list. I didn't see anything on there talking about ODFW charging other agencies they would do for the work they do for them.
That's correct. I don't think we did. We did discuss that.
It wasn't discussed in the task force, although that is something that's pending, and we might have the department come up and tell you a little bit about
the
status of that.
There's a lot of money out there that ODFW puts out to do work that other agencies get paid for, but ODFW doesn't get
providing those resources. Yeah.
Why don't we have the department come up
as soon as
Mark finishes his presentation, and also for answering questions. Oh, Kurt is here. Okay. Well, why don't you answer it now since you came up? So.
Well, I'm sorry. Did you not want me up now?
Okay.
You're in the hot seat now. And the question was,
how much money, and I know you have a study on this, I think it was a 2-year study, how much money does ODFW spend on projects for other agencies regarding conservation, environmental issues, ESA issues, that other agencies charge the stakeholder that needs the information, but they don't pay you?
Sure. And Chair Edwards and Senator Olson, as you mentioned, we actually have a study that's underway right now. We don't have the answer to that question yet. And it is something that the task force did talk, and we did talk to the task force a little bit about. But right now, we don't have the information to say what the value of that work is.
Well, follow up, if I can just ask.
Could you?
I'm sorry. For the record, Kurt Melcher, Director of Department of Fish and Wildlife.
Follow up.
Yep.
And this is just a hypothetical, but with the payroll that you have, it's got to be a substantial amount, the time that your folks spend on work for other agencies.
And Chair Edwards and Senator Olson, there's multiple levels to the answer to that question. We do a whole lot of work with other agencies, basically in collaboration with them, because we don't manage habitat, but fish and wildlife need habitat, so we work collaboratively with them. Then there's also regulatory processes where we're required either by statute or administrative rule, other agencies' administrative rules, to engage in those regulatory processes. We're right now in the process of determining precisely what the cost of the full range of activities is, so that we'll be able to say what it costs the staff time that's engaged in other agencies' regulatory processes that are essentially forced or required of us, and then what the other costs associated, for instance, with federal ESA related activities, what those costs are as well.
Thank you.
Okay.
Let me stay.
Yeah.
Stay.
I wouldn't go far, but you can sit in the front row if you want.
I might need some backup here. So we developed some criteria to base the recommendations on. I'm just going to quickly go through those. We want to make sure it was sufficient to address the need. We want to make sure it was sustainable so we don't have this flash in the pan. Well, we got to raise the license fees and then wait 5 years and raise them again. So we wanted to make sure it was sustainable. It's got to be stable and flexible, diverse and equitable. It also addresses the diversity segments, cost-effective. It's got to be defensible so that when you talk to your constituents about it, that it could be defensible, politically feasible, and you're going to have to take some tough votes, and we got to make sure that we have your back and it's politically feasible, politically insulated. So the preliminary recommendations came down to two. After we established an Oregon Conservation Fund, there's two funding mechanisms recommended for consideration. One is an income tax surcharge. It's applied to individual, non-corporate tax returns based on a percentage of taxable income, a portion for out-of-state and partial tax filers, as an exemption for low-income filers, historic contribution by hunters and fishers in financing conservation acknowledged by providing an annual resident fishing and hunting license holders either an income tax credit, a reduction in license fees, sunsetted exemption and surcharge. And we still have some discussion that we have a little bit of a difference of opinion in some of the task force members. So we are going to explore that one, that bottom one, some more.
Mr. Chair, so, yeah. If we do an income tax surcharge, how do you guarantee that the money goes to Fish and Wildlife because it goes into the general fund?
Well, Mr. Chair, Senator Olson, the statute would dedicate it directly to the agency. So that would be in the, at least how I would see it, would be in the legislation.
It's earmarked. Fair. I mean, the statute could dedicate it, but it's not. I mean, the statute can't bind a subsequent legislature to, if it's statutory.
It just seems to me that if you have a dedicated amount that's supposed to be coming out, all they're doing is collecting in the Department of Revenue, and then they have a duty to disperse and put it into a specific account, just like we do with other dedicated amounts.
Oh no, I agree. I'm just saying, as any legislature can say, notwithstanding, you know, and do whatever.
There's actually two features there, notwithstanding, and the other thing is you can always deal an equal amount of money off the bottom of the deck to somebody else.
So, Mark, the decision to limit this to individual tax returns, income taxes, so was that because the benefit of this would accrue on individuals as opposed to corporate, or what was the rationale for that?
I'm trying to think. That brought in the most amount of money, and that was for the criteria, sir, Senator Edwards, Senator Dembro.
I think the nexus there was that all the people who benefit from the resources would be paying for the resource, and the corporate entity doesn't truly benefit from the resource.
That's the reason we had Senator Whitsitt on our committee. Thank you, sir. The beverage container surcharge, interesting that you just had the beverage folks prior to us. So this is a little bit different than the bottle bill itself. This would be a surcharge at the wholesale level on beverage containers. A percentage surcharge assessed at the wholesale level on beverage containers subject to the bottle bill effective in January 1, 2017. Applied to the cost of the beverage rather than as an addition to the beverage container redemption. So it'd be an additional cost, and I'll get to the cost here in a second. And the revenue projections do not include products that are being added to the bottle bill effective on January 1, 2018. So now let's look at the dollar amounts. The Oregon income tax surcharge, the task force discussed this at length. Remember that the agency is about $80 million per biennium short. So for 2017-19, if the bill passed and you had this in place, that would bring in about $60 million. And the reason that that's not 80 is because the timing of when it's implemented. So it isn't a full biennium. So if you get to the full biennium cost in 2019-21, it would be $92.9 million. And because it's a percentage, it continues on. It isn't just a one-time cost. The beverage containers, similar. It's a 2.02 cents or percent, which is only a couple cents at the wholesale level. And for 2017-19, it'd be about $60 million, and in 1921, it would be about $82 million. And so the cost of a beverage is going to go from up from 5 cents to 10 cents. So people's costs are going to go up, and we're saying the nexus there is if you want to support, you know, the conservation efforts throughout the state of Oregon, and the survey shows that people do support that, and adding a couple cents onto that increase that would be directed toward conservation programs not funded by hunters and fishers now, we think there's a pretty good strong nexus there with the criteria that we were looking at.
Mr. Chair.
Okay.
Thank you. Two things. Number one, that's going to be a hard sell, beverage container surcharge, because a lot of people live in the city, don't go to the country. I mean, you know what the country looks like. Why didn't you go after rental car fees?
No, we did talk, Senator Olson, we did talk about that. It didn't bring in enough money.
Yeah, how much can you?
I don't have it right here in front of me, but we did do an analysis of that. In fact, that was, I think, the chair of the commission was pushing that pretty strongly. So,
because that makes people from out of state pay.
Well,
they're the ones that enjoy our outdoors too.
Yes, sir. That's correct. But people that visit our state and buy a bottle of water or a Diet Coke or whatever that come here to visit us, they'll be paying that 2%.
Yeah, but
surcharge there also.
Most of it's going to be paid to Oregonians.
And it's safe to say, I mean, just my observation of the difficult work that the task force has taken up is there's a theme. It's trying to get somebody else to pay. I mean, it seems like it's always a theme when it comes to funding and taxes and fees. There, you notice none of the members of the task force, none of the proposals tax their industry.
Right.
Now, sporting goods, they're on the task force, strong opposition. You know, and so the people that are being, that would be paying were not necessarily represented on the task force directly. I mean, the income, the surcharge is one thing, but the beverage, stakeholders in the beverage container realm were not on the task force.
Yeah, I would only add that I think the thinking of the task force was all Oregonians believe that fish and wildlife resources are important, and all Oregonians ought to share in that rather than just fishers and hunters who pay the lion's share right now. And if you believe the survey that says that all Oregonians value those resources, then the nexus would be is saying, well, all Oregonians, would you be willing to contribute a couple cents to that or to help fund that resource? So that.
But the survey should have said, would you be willing to contribute a couple $100s, because at the end of the year, that's what it's going to cost.
Yes.
And then you'd probably find that the survey would not be indicative of, oh, yeah, I want to do that. And I wholeheartedly believe that, you know, we need to protect our state. I would think that you would have waited for the conclusion of the director's report on how much money they can recoup from charging other agencies.
We passed a bill directing them to do it now. So,
oh, okay.
Yeah, Senator, we were directed to report to you today.
Oh, gotcha.
So,
yeah. And that came up a number of times during the, I mean, you know, you saw all the ideas.
Yeah.
I threw cold water on many or most of them, just from a political feedback standpoint of trying to explain to commission members, okay, so here are the stakeholders that are in the legislature that care about these different areas, and here's the political history on the bottle bill. Here is, you know, on the marijuana taxes. Here is who's, you know, wrestling over that pot of money already, and providing some perspective. And in fairness, you know, members of the task force said, look, if the legislature could have gotten this done, they would have gotten it done. And they asked us to make a recommendation. So they move forward in good faith and are doing what the members in that room every month think is the best approach. So
So, Mr. Chair, I should have you give the report. So, very good. So, I would only add one thing is the task force feels very strongly that this is an interim report. We have been directed to come to you for your advice and counsel, and so we don't see this as the final report. What we'd like to get is your direction. We'll be going before Representative Witt's committee tomorrow. Get your direction, advice, get your counsel. Are we on the right track? If we're not, tell us if we are, or if you want to tweak it. We consider this an interim report, and that we have some time before the legislature fires up in February that we could take your advice and counsel and go back to do some more interim work on it. So they feel pretty strongly about that this is not the final report. We need your advice and your counsel. So,
and what's it?
Just very briefly on the sales tax on beverage containers. That's going to be characterized as a regressive tax because it's not apportioned to somebody's ability to pay. So that's something you might want to think about and prepare rhetoric for. Or, you know.
Okay, thank you.
Well, I think, Mr. Chair, if I could just add to that, even the income tax surcharge, which is a flat rate, although it's kind of a flat tax sort of component that does also potentially go against the notion of progressivity.
We were actually told that would be unconstitutional if it isn't a person for ability to pay.
Yeah, and was it not considered, and I don't know where the task force is now, but making it, stepping it, so if you're, you know, in this income bracket, it's this much, or is it just straight percentage?
It exempts low-income filers, $20,000 and under.
Oh, there's the exemption.
Low income.
Okay.
Yeah. And then there was also a long conversation about exempting hunters and fishers who are already paying.
Yes, sir, it does. Yep. Program adjustment recommendations. What this would do is expand the implementation of the Oregon Conservation Strategy, the nearshore component and other conservation effort. Proposed funding shifts to keep license fees from increasing or allow for actual fee reductions. Potential contracting for administration of future grant programs with another agency. Better engagement with diverse and underrepresented communities, expanded contracting with underrepresented groups, expansion of existing programs of technical assistance to private landowners, contract for expertise in marketing and education rather than hiring staff to conduct those programs. Leverage funds at the federal level available for conservation. Leverage funds and expands partnerships with other state agencies. Continues to partner with public and private entities that own or manage land and projects to improve and restore habitat. Increase opportunities to coordinate with the outdoor recreation industries. Support for the national legislation, the Blue Ribbon Committee national legislation for funding. It supports, we're going to be very strong supporters of that. Monitoring and measuring outcomes, indexing license fees, education, engagement, program feasibility. And I think that is it. And he tried to do that in 15 minutes. One thing that that I tried to lobby for all the way along, we have a very diverse group that attends our meetings. And you have people on this side and this side, and I think it's pretty clear that they all want to see an adequately funded Department of Fish and Wildlife. They might not agree on policy in certain areas. One might agree this policy, another policy, but I think they all agree that adequate funding of the agency is important, long-term sustainable funding of the agency is important. The path that the legislature has set them on is not a path that, in my opinion, that you want to continue the agency on, which is essentially raising hunting and fishing license fees on a continuing basis, and we need to look for some alternate funding sources so it's not all on the backs of hunters and fishers. We need to implement the conservation strategy. We need to do that in a way that all Oregonians share in that effort, and this is what we're trying to do, and we need your help and guidance on helping to do that. That would result in a bill that you think would pass muster with the legislature.
Senator Przanski.
So has the report actually been put together that you're supposed to give to us? or is it still in a form that you could add to it?
I actually, the draft report should have been, I don't have it right here. Here it is. The draft report, you should have that sent to you. So, and as you see, it says interim task report. So apologize. We've been working on this right to the bitter end, and I think you just got it last night. Is that correct, Beth? Yeah. So I apologize that you haven't got the full report. But
it's still in somewhat of a draft form.
Yes, sir.
Okay. So some of the comments I heard, it seems to me on the funding issues, you may want to capture that if you're actually going to formalize the final report, the options that Senator Olson has brought forward. I just think that those things should be out there on the table. And I know it says in here these are potential funding ways, and there's the two, but it seems to me there's maybe another combination that we'd want to look at that could capture maybe not as much money on the rental cars, but maybe that's part of the final package.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Senator Brzezinski, that's exactly what we're here for, is to hear your thoughts, and so we can incorporate them into our next meeting.
No. Senator Dembro.
Yeah, thanks, Mr. Chair. Kurt, maybe you said this and I didn't hear it. What is the timeline for the study that you're doing on the costs incurred from other agencies?
Sure. Senator Chair Edwards and Senator Dembro, we've got, we basically began that on July 1 of this year. So we developed an online tool that our staff is now using. Of course, the nature of that work is fairly cyclical over the course of the year, depending on what activities, construction, fill and removal activities that are going on. So we're looking at basically after, well, being about another 9 months from now, having a full year of activity that we'll be able to really get a good handle on what the costs of these processes are for us.
So you can't do this in a look-back manner to see what your past expenses have been?
No, Chair Edwards and Senator Dembro, we do not have the irony, and as I mentioned to the task force, I think multiple times, the irony as an agency of data, where data is what we do not have data about, you know, with precision about what our staff, how our staff time is spent. We certainly have made rough estimates, you know, but absent real empirical data and rigor, all we have are simple estimates, and they're not nearly at the level of detail that we would want to have to answer these kind of questions. House Bill 3315 directs us to start billing those other agencies for our participation in their regulatory processes in 2019, and it gives basically a two-year ramp up to, one, allow us to put systems in place to be able to estimate what those costs are, and then, two, to allow the other agencies to start planning for those future expenditures.
Thank you both. We need to move on. We have three more presentations to get through in 45 minutes. So thank you both. Thanks for the hard work of the task force. It's not easy, and but I appreciate your dedication to the mission. All right, next up, we have a report from the Task Force on Independent Scientific Review for Natural Resources, Dan Edge, co-chair. Dan, and we have you allotted for 20 minutes, and we cannot go over 20 minutes. So take it away.
Chair Edwards, senators, good afternoon. Once again, my name is Dan Edge. I'm an associate dean in the College of Agricultural Sciences at Oregon State University and have served as the co-chair of this task force. My partner in crime, Barbara Bond, was unable to join us today, and I can guarantee you this will take 10 minutes. My purpose today really is to present our report, which we were directed by Senate Bill 202 to deliver to the legislature on the 15th of this month. I have two images here. All of you should have received, in fact, the entire Legislative Assembly, and many of our stakeholders and agencies received the executive summary, the two-page executive summary pictured on the left. The executive summary gives a web link to the final report pictured on the right, which is 92 pages, which includes just 32 pages of text, and the rest of it is appendices detailing the work that we did. The Senate Bill 202 gave us four basic charges. The first charge was simply to determine if independent scientific review was needed for the state of Oregon, and if the answer to that came out to be yes, then we had three other charges to recommend one or more entities to host a review agency, to recommend whether or not the review process would require legislative authority, and then finally to recommend a structure and function of process for independent scientific review. We had a 13-member task force, which was just exceptional. And that task force was appointed by the governor based upon consultations with the vice presidents of research at our three major research institutions and input from stakeholder groups. The task force had broad, diverse interest and representation.
Sorry to interrupt you, but I do have a little concern with that task force, the way it's, the membership is made up. It has 10 academics, two businessmen, and one in the Nature Conservancy. And I don't see any representation there from the private forestry, private agriculture, private mining, that sort of thing.
Chair Edwards, Senator Whitsitt, thank you. I guess I can't address how the governor picked the people to serve. I know she consulted with the vice presidents of the research institutions, which is probably why those folks were primarily academics. But beyond that.
Just observing.
Yeah, thank you. I did want to point out that the functions of the task force were supported by three members of the Institute for Natural Resources, Oregon State University, Jeff Behan, Sarah Brennan, and Lisa Gaines provided exceptional support for the task force, in fact, wrote most of the report or the appendices. The Institute for Natural Resources also contracted with a facilitator, Jane Barth, who managed the task and the meetings. The report outlines the approach we took. It was pretty standard for a state process. We had six meetings, lots of public outreach. We put up a website with all the materials on it. We had webinars presenting our preliminary report. The support from the Institute for Natural Resources, they did a very comprehensive literature review and did agency and stakeholder surveys to get input from folks about scientific review processes. And once again, we did have a comprehensive outreach process, and we received written comments from 13 stakeholders to our initial draft. We had four basic findings, and then we had four basic recommendations. And the first finding was that Oregon would indeed benefit from an independent scientific review process for natural resources, especially in some of these wicked questions. But how a review is done is just as important from the standpoint of how it's constructed and conducted, and that's important from the standpoint of making sure the process works well. Findings two and three, we found that most single agency reviews, most of our natural resource agencies have internal staff or conduct some external reviews for questions pertaining just to their own agency. But there are variations in how those reviews are done, and the capacity varies substantially among our different agencies. We found that clearly there's a need for independent scientific review of these complex, multidisciplinary questions which span the regulatory authority of multiple natural resource agencies. And that's where we just don't have the capacity to address those types of questions now. The last question was that we found that there are models of review processes around the country in other states and at the federal level, and those can help inform us how we develop ours. But the point that we settled on was that Oregon has some special interest and challenges associated with science, and it requires a process tailored to meet Oregon needs. So we had four recommendations. The first recommendation was to indeed create a robust, appropriately resourced, independent scientific review process for natural resources in Oregon. And once again, these would focus on these complex transdisciplinary or multidisciplinary questions that span control of several agencies. We propose, recommend that there be created a new entity, Oregon ISR Board, and then have review-specific review panels, which are both supported by a coordinating arm we're calling the ISR Secretariat, which would be hosted at a current entity in the state. This is sort of the structure that we envisioned for this process, and we thought it was important that anyone could ask a scientific question of this new board. And so the agencies, the governor's office, the legislators, stakeholder groups, organizations, or just the general public could ask. And then the secretariat and the board would work together to help refine the questions, better focus the questions, and then would determine whether or not it was a question the state should invest their resources in, if it met the criteria that we outlined in our report, which would identify whether or not it's a valid question for review. And then we would stand up panels, appoint a panel specifically for that particular question. Recommendation number three. Everything we looked at, the other organizations that have review processes all have either congressional or legislative authority for doing that, and we think that's what we need in this case. And then finally, once again, these multidisciplinary or transdisciplinary complex questions, the wicked questions that face our natural resource agencies, is important from the standpoint of getting clarity from a scientific review process. And we recommended a cost-effective process for doing that. This is the process. I'm not going to spend really any time with it. We anticipate that most reviews would take approximately a year. There'd be some time up front to better focus those questions and determine exactly what the issue was and how it might impinge upon public policy, and to help refine the process. And then once that was determined, we'd have a budget decision process, and then we would invite a panel to begin working on it. After some amount of time, probably 6 months at least, the panel would begin working on a draft report, solicit input, and then finally the report would be released. And depending upon the product, there may be substantial educational outreach associated with it. We think that's actually a pretty good service of this independent review process. Once again, depending upon where the review is requested in a policy process, we envision that there might be several types of products. You might have formal or informal consultations. That's sort of the first step, where we may not actually conduct a review, but we could help our stakeholders identify how to better define the science questions they're interested in. There could be formally researched and written reviews or consensus reports. We could imagine cases where perhaps the board would convene workshops, symposia, or conferences, develop white papers, synthesis of the knowledge. And we think this would be an appropriate place for the board to help our state agencies develop specific criteria and best practices for conducting their own internal reviews. So anyway, our process, we think, has several principles, or we propose the process with several principles. Once we think it's going to be cost effective. A lot of money is spent in the courts arguing over science, and we think we could save the state substantial resources. It would be clear about maintain the integrity. We would try to reduce bias and conflicts of interest in the selection of the panels and the boards. We think it would be very useful for our state agencies to have high quality science reviewed in the process of their decision making. The process we've designed is flexible. It could handle three to maybe multiple reviews a year, depending upon what kind of products might be envisioned. And then it is transparent and inclusive. From a funding standpoint, we think that we need to maintain a secretariat, the ISR secretariat, which would be composed of a half-time director and then a full-time technical assistant that would help with the writing and the research, and a full-time program coordinator. And then the boards themselves, excuse me, the panels themselves would be funded on a per diem basis of for per diem and travel associated with the time that the panel members spend on the questions. So Oregon needs an independent scientific review process, and the key points to that are the questions have to have rigor in how they are asked and posed. They need to be transdisciplinary in nature. We think they need to have a high likelihood of having impact on natural resource policy in the state. The questions should be regional or statewide in scope, and they should be future oriented. We don't think there's any point in having a review of decisions made in the past. We need to think about the future. It needs to be a transparent process, and what we've designed is transparent, and there needs to be sufficient funds to allow this to happen. We think we discussed a lot about a pay-to-play kind of system, and we don't think that's going to work very well. We think that's going to invariably result in the people that have the most money getting the questions they want asked versus perhaps a less financially rich agency. And with that, I will close. Our website here, the web address, directs you to the full report and then the executive summary. Again, and with that, if we have time, I'll take questions.
We have 2 minutes.
I do have a question. Yeah, Dr. Edge, are there other states that have something resembling this, you know, this kind of process and a secretariat or whatever they would call it?
Chair Edwards, Senator Dimbrough, yes, both Washington and California have a similar process. Washington does not have a secretariat supporting it. It's done with some of the state agencies. California does have more of a similar process, and of course the National Research Council has sort of a very similar structure, only much, much larger, and they do use a pay-to-play kind of process. Thank you.
Chair Wilson.
Yes, we spent quite a bit of time the last couple of years looking at a legislative policy office, similar to that type of research. And one of the problems that we tried to resolve, and I didn't hear you mention, was how do you remain politically neutral in the selection process?
Yeah, Chair Edwards, Senator Whitsitt, excellent question. And some of the input we received from the stakeholders that provided us comment, basically we identify a list of criteria that might be used in selecting a panel member. It sort of depends upon the question that is being addressed. You may have a question which is so focused there are only two or three scientists in the country or maybe nationwide that have a high level of expertise in that. What you do want to avoid is people that have a direct conflict of interest. The legislature is very familiar with those kind of issues. And you need to avoid people that have clear bias one way or the other. I think so we provide a number of criteria by which the panel members might be selected. But that is a key question that some of the stakeholders asked about that they had concerns about.
Thank you for being here to present. And this is a topic that is of significant interest to me. I'll read the summary and I'll come to session with lots of questions.
So we don't, just don't have time to get into all of them right now, but thank you.
Understand. Thank you, Chair Edwards. If you have questions, please give us a call.
Okay. All right. Up next, update on Cleaner Air Oregon and the human health rulemaking related to industrial emissions. Palmer Mason, Sarah Armitage, Gabriella Goldfarb. We have 30 minutes, so 5 o'clock, that's 29 minutes and 30 seconds, including questions. And then we've got a 10-minute update from Senator Denbro and Kevin Downing on the Clean Diesel Program, or about the Clean Diesel Work Group after that. And then we really have to get out of here for another meeting. So. Palmer.
Yeah. Chair Edwards, members of the committee, my name is Palmer Mason. I am the legislative advisor for the Department of Environmental Quality. We were here in May to talk with you about the Cleaner Air Oregon initiative, and a major part of that being a focused rulemaking on industrial emissions, the air toxics related to industrial emissions. It is a partnership between the Oregon Health Authority and the department, this rulemaking. So I have here with me Gabriella Goldfarb, who is now with the Oregon Health Authority, and she'll say a few words about her agency's involvement in this. It's been critical to the work that we've done. And then Sarah Armitage is here with the DEQ staff to talk about the rule, provide you a little bit of context about how we got here and what the rule is proposed to do, as well as tell you what the latest steps are and future steps around that rulemaking. And we'll just go ahead and proceed with Gabriella and then Sarah.
For the record, Chair Edwards, members of the committee, Gabriella Goldfarb, now the Environmental Public Health Section Manager for the Oregon Health Authority in the Public Health Division. And I'm here today, I will be very brief. I really want to affirm and underscore the strong partnership that has been developed between our two agencies in carrying out what has been a very intensive initiative. And the agency is committed to putting its public health expertise behind this effort, which includes not only being able to explain the health effects of exposure to pollutants, but also how to engage the community. That's been a big part of what we've brought to this partnership. In the interest of time, because you are very pressed, I will cede the rest of my comments to my DEQ colleague, Sarah Armitage.
Good afternoon, members of the committee. My name is Sarah Armitage. I'm with Oregon DEQ. I'm going to give you a little background first. On where we are, where we've come from, just sort of a refresher on Cleaner Air Oregon. Cleaner Air Oregon will reform regulations for industrial air toxics. Industrial use of metals, chemicals, and other materials can result in release of toxic air pollutants, as we know. This can increase the level of risk for people's health because industrial facilities are often located in communities with lower income levels and communities of color. Some people may be more affected than others. Cleaner Air Oregon will reform rules for what industrial facilities across the state can put into the air. There are other statewide DEQ programs, as you can see here, that control air pollution from many sources, both to reduce toxic air pollution and meet federal air quality standards. So a little bit more on background. Our existing air toxics regulations for industry reduce toxics for many facilities. They tell facilities how to operate, so they limit the amount of pollutants released into the air. For example, they might require a facility to filter its emissions if it's using a toxic material. However, our existing regulations are based on federal regulations from the Environmental Protection Agency. And while they've done a lot of good over the years in reducing emissions, they don't take into account specific conditions in our state. They also don't cover all industry types and all air toxics. Sometimes they only apply to larger industries within a category and only certain air toxics emitted by a facility. And they don't look at how air toxics affect the health of people living right near the facilities. So we now have a really great opportunity to strengthen our state program to address potential health risk to people who live near industrial facilities. Again, as a bit of a review, here's what Cleaner Air Oregon will do. It will determine concentration limits on different substances that affect the health of people living nearby. It will give us better information to make decisions. It will set limits on toxic air emissions for industrial facilities based on impact to human health. It will give businesses clear direction and guidance on regulations. And this will provide certainty and consistency about how they need to operate. Cleaner Air Oregon will consider the impact on business, jobs, and local economies. So overall, Cleaner Air Oregon will improve air quality for people living near industrial facilities statewide. Now I'll describe a little bit about our progress to date on Cleaner Air Oregon. We've been very busy. We've made a lot of progress since this first started. And in current Cleaner Air Oregon work, we've investigated six other states that have health risk-based air toxics programs. These are permitting programs, and we've looked at them in depth, and we've identified program elements and performed analysis of all of those elements to try to understand how we could potentially form ours. So there are basic elements common to most programs, including delineation of who they apply to, which businesses, the use of tools to screen emissions for potential risk to human health, more in-depth risk assessment for facilities that pass through, say, a de minimis assessment or a first-level screening, and then there are measures to decrease emissions that cause unacceptable levels of risk. Using this information, we've held four technical work group meetings to get input from technical experts on pros and cons of different options and elements produced, and updated seven issue papers to document both work group and public input and discussion. We did have very good public attendance at all of our technical work group meetings. So all of these papers and a final report are available on DEQ's Cleaner Air, it's DEQ and Oregon Health Authority's Cleaner Air Oregon website. So in the materials that we provided you, you'll find the membership and credentials of our technical work group. And we've really been very fortunate for the level of expertise and input from these volunteers. We recruited top folks from around the country with expertise in toxicology, air toxics control, and health risk-based permitting programs to help us. Also, early on in our process with the technical work group, we started including a focus on environmental justice, and we've surveyed other states on how they handle environmental justice concerns in their air permitting programs. To date, Health and DEQ have conducted two of four policy forums for interested people and the general public around the state. We've completed Medford and Bend, and next we're going to Pendleton and Portland. There are many issues to discuss with people. There's a lot of complexity in forming this type of program. So for the regional forum discussions, we focused on a few key issues, like program scope, how we'll approach implementation, how we will establish air toxics levels to protect public health, and how best to address cumulative risk or exposure to multiple air toxics from the many facilities and other sources like vehicle engines, wood burning, and fuel use. The goal of the regional forums is to engage interested people statewide, to listen to their input and concerns, and to bring this knowledge to the next step of our public involvement process, which is work with a policy advisory committee. So this is what we're about to launch after we're done with the public forums around the state. We have selected a 23-member policy advisory committee to provide additional focused feedback on all of the program options. We also have two co-chairs to steward this process. And this is a structured way to get focused input from a broad array of people with relevant expertise. The members of this policy advisory committee represent perspectives including environmental groups, business associations, environmental justice advocates, cities and counties, local health authorities, health advocacy associations, neighborhood groups, large and small business, an industrial union, a pollution control engineer, and an academic with relevant experience. So also, the roster for this committee is available in the materials that we've provided to you and also on the Cleaner Air Oregon website. We're currently preparing for a series of 6 all-day policy advisory committee meetings between October 2016 and April 2017. Since there's a lot of complexity in developing a health risk-based air toxics permitting program, we know that working through these options will be a large task. We've used the foundation of technical work group issue papers to prepare these 6 discussion papers for the Policy Advisory Committee, and these papers further analyze the pros and cons of various options, and they also leave space for committee discussion and identification and analysis of new options. The advisory committee will also have the benefit of input from participants in our regional forums. So for next steps, it's our goal to have draft regulations prepared and out on public notice next May for approximately 2 months, and we have the goal of final adoption by December 2017. And you also have the overall timeline in your materials with all the steps along the way. We expect extensive public comment on the draft regulations, and between August and October 2017, the staff will be summarizing, considering, and responding to the public comment, and in some cases we may change the proposed regulations based on that. And we'll be preparing the necessary documents for our Environmental Quality Commission meeting in December 2017. So there are ongoing engagement opportunities for everyone who's interested in this, including those 2 remaining evening regional forums in Pendleton. They're on September 28th and in Portland on October 5th. We also regularly update the Cleaner Air Oregon website. It's a great place to find out what's going on with monitoring, different actions, meetings, all sorts of updates. You can also get updates on social media. We have an email inbox for people who want to ask us questions, and we get those to the right people, and we'll get back to you on any questions. So I'd be happy to answer any questions you have right now if there's time for that.
There's time, or we could questions?
Yeah. Thank you.
Senator, what's it?
I think it's an important program that certainly needs to be based on good science and not politics. So I actually 3 questions, and if you don't know the answers, you can give them to me. But what is the DEQ OHA's statutory authority to do this on the rulemaking? And then how are the health effects to be determined, and also your degree of confidence in that determination? And also, on what parameters are the health-based limits on emissions based? And once again, what is your degree of confidence?
Sure. Well, I will try to address your 3 questions. If others have, they might have more to say about this. So we looked at our authority before we started out. Oregon 468 and 468A have general authority for DEQ to adopt and implement regulations to protect air quality and to limit any emission of air pollution that could be affecting public health. So that is the general authority that we have for our programs right now. We don't have anything specific to this program, but it covers air toxics. So the next thing you asked was, how do we determine health effects? All right. Well, this is kind of a complex topic. The science on air toxics has been building for the last 20 years. We've seen great leaps, actually, in understanding of the different air toxics that we have in our airshed, ways to monitor them, ways to estimate their health effects. And this is something that we do in conjunction with our health partners, especially toxicologists. And so we look at the chemicals that are in our air. We know those from monitoring, sometimes computer modeling, and knowledge of what facilities, not just industrial facilities, but what wood stoves and cars and diesel engines are putting out. So we know what's in the air, and then we get the data about these pollutants, and we look at the toxicology and the epidemiology and the medical data for each pollutant. And for each one, there's a body of medical and scientific knowledge about the types of health effects that they cause and at which levels. And so then we can compare those levels to what we've monitored in the air or what we've estimated, or in the case of an industrial facility, there can often be modeling of those emissions at fence line or at, you know, potential sites nearby where people could be breathing the pollution. So that's how we understand the health effects. And most of the air toxics we address in the state at their lower levels are either suspected or known to cause cancer effects. And some of them are known or suspected to cause non-cancer health effects, such as respiratory irritation and neurological damage. So there, right now we have about 187 on the federal list, and in Oregon we focus on 52. And in this developing program, we're considering going beyond and looking at some other chemicals that may be present in the air and tracking those back to the epidemiological data and then understanding what health concerns could be from those pollutants.
You didn't mention that your degree of confidence in these literature reviews and in their application. I mean, are you going to have some degree of confidence before we start regulating people?
Yes, that's a very important question to us as well. It and our level of certainty and confidence comes in at many levels. Again, at assessment, where you know we do monitoring, that is pretty good certainty. We know what detection levels are, and if we're above a detection level, we do quality assurance on the data, and that's very well known. When we do computer modeling or estimates, a little less certainty there, but we can compare it to monitoring to see how well our models perform. When we look at data, toxicology, and medical data about all these chemicals, there are also varying levels of robustness or certainty about that data. So, for instance, for the chemical benzene, there's very well-established medical data on the effects that it can cause blood cancers, and that is known from worker studies on humans. And for other pollutants, there's less clear data. So we may have animal studies that become extrapolated to human health. And it is a range of data.
Any other questions? Did you guys all, did two of you speak while I was out? Oh, okay. I thought we had one more. Awkward pause. I'm like, and.
It was kind of like, yeah. I'm going to give my time, yield my time.
Yeah, okay. Got it. Any other questions then?
No, I'm just glad to see the work happening. Yeah.
I think they actually just want to get you back and us on.
I know. I mean, you just caught us up. So okay. Thank you each.
Okay.
And we have one more presentation for the afternoon. And that is an update on the diesel work group. So Senator Dembro and Kevin Downing.
Get on the dog, you're stupid.
Okay, thanks, Mr. Chair, colleagues. I'm Michael Dembro, Senator for District 23, and I've been chairing the work group on diesel engine emission mitigation that has been functioning since the spring. And I'm not going to go into a whole lot of detail because I was asked to limit this to 5 minutes, and go into a more extensive presentation in December during our ledge days.
And we asked you for 5 minutes because you're a legislator, so we knew that it would take at least 10. So.
Thank you.
I limit myself the same way.
You've already given it up now.
So first of all, let me say that this work group is a follow-up to legislation that was proposed back in 2015, Senate Bill 824, which looked at how we can deal with the issue of
alleviating the negative health effects of diesel emissions, and more specifically, how we could take advantage of the new engine technology to reduce those health impacts. Just as background, because of federal action, any new diesel engines that are built, certainly after 2010, are quite clean in terms of diesel particulates. And if everyone were driving them or using them, we would not have a problem.
Clean relative to previous technologies, or just like
just really absolutely. Actually, one of the interesting things that we learned is
out of the
that
tailpipe in your
yes,
sense.
That you can rats can breathe out of a tailpipe of the new technology and not develop cancer. This is, you know, very new research that's been done, but it's appears to be very promising. So the challenge, of course, is that diesel engines, I mean, their strength is that they do a lot of work and they live a long time. So how can we create a framework, both regulatory and through incentives, to speed up that transition time? So to do it in a way that creates the least negative impact on industry, but gives us the health benefits as quickly as possible. So to address this, we have assembled a very broad set of members of this work group. We have legislators, we have local electeds, we have agency people, we have industry, both on-road and off-road, large companies, small companies, labor, environmental, and public health advocates. We have a scientist, Linda George, who teaches atmospheric science at Portland State University. And we've also actually been really fortunate to have participation from some people who went through this experience in California, both at the agency level, industry level, and consulting level, which has really been beneficial, I think, to us. So we now, I think, I personally, and I think the other members of the group, have a much better sense of the health impacts of the older diesel, the opportunities provided by retrofits and the newer diesel, how the program has worked in California, both what they would do differently if they could do it over again, as well as those things that seem to work well. We have a much better sense of where we are in terms of our, particularly on the on-road side, because vehicles need to be registered with DMV. We have a pretty good sense of where we are, in terms of the age and nature of our fleets on the public sector side. We still have work to do to find out exactly where we are on the off-road side, particularly with respect to construction. We still have work to do to find out just what how we're affected by federal preemptions in place to address this issue. LC is working on that. But we are, I think, coming to a much better sense of a shared sense of what our priorities should be as we address this, in terms of focusing the most on the areas of densest population where the most individuals who are potentially at health risk from off-road and on-road diesel that those are the priorities, vulnerable populations, children, elderly people, et cetera. And we are, I think, just getting to the point now of what a recommendation would look like. We're starting to talk about the nitty-gritty. And so that's why I think if I come back in December, I'll be able to share some really concrete things with you. One of the things that we are looking for is how to help create incentives to speed up transitions. And one of the opportunities that has come our way fortuitously is the Volkswagen settlement.
which is going to bring some dollars to the state of Oregon to help deal with this very issue. So we have Kevin here, Kevin Downing, who's really the expert in this area, and he's going to talk to you about what the opportunities are, but also the limitations, because the settlement dollars need to be used in a pretty specific way. So with that, I will turn it over to him, if that's okay. And
a great internal clock here. Yeah. It's 5 minutes right on.
All right. I, too, have that caucus meeting and, to think about.
So that means I have 10, right? Good afternoon, Chair and members of the committee. My name is Kevin Downing. I work for the Department of Environmental Quality in the Air Quality Planning Section. And as the senator suggested, what I wanted to talk to you about was the settlement of litigation against Volkswagen. For this represents a settlement of several federal, state, and consumer claims related to the installation of emission-controlled defeat devices on 2.0-liter diesel passenger cars. There's actually another cause of action related to 3.0-liter diesel cars, also manufactured by Volkswagen, Audi, and Porsche, and that's ongoing. That's not part of the conversation that we're having right now. This settlement, as proposed here in June of this year, but not quite yet finalized, has three elements. One relating to the owners of the cars, two, a payment by Volkswagen to a program to promote zero-emission vehicles, and the third I want to spend a little more time on, which is actually a fund established under the decree, the Environmental Mitigation Fund, which is will consist of $2.7 billion contribution by Volkswagen distributed to states based on a share of the registered VW diesel cars licensed in those particular states. This represents about at least $68 million payment to the state of Oregon. This is intended to serve as mitigation for the excess NOx emissions from the prior occurrence, as well as for ongoing excess NOx emissions from the cars, as the buyback and the repair program moves forward. The court has described seven categories of eligible mitigation actions, including investments on trucks, ferries, tugs, locomotives, airport ground support equipment, forklifts, what did I leave out? Zero-emission vehicles, and ocean-going shore power as well. So it's a fairly narrow and prescribed list of activities intended to address excess NOx emissions from mobile sources. DEQ will be the designated agency to oversee expenditures over the next 10 years. In the process of, within that paradigm developed by the court, there's still opportunity to establish priorities for how the money should be spent. DEQ intends to engage with stakeholders over the next several months to identify what those priorities should be. We have a webpage up already. We are building a mailing list with, at this point, several hundred people on it. We're holding a webinar next Tuesday to outline the terms of the decree as we understand. As I mentioned, the court is considering public comments received from the Department of Justice and will likely finalize the decree by mid to late October. There will be actually a legislative involvement in this process as well, involving approving statutory authority for the state to receive these funds, as well as for the department itself, budgetary authority to receive the funds, and you'll see also a policy option package for including positions to administer the program. And I'm happy to answer any questions you might have. There were some materials that we submitted to you, quite dense in terms of words, but I just also wanted to, we did that deliberately in a sense to kind of convey the bounds on which the court established around what they would consider eligible expenditures for the money. So I'll happily answer any questions you might have.
And Mr. Chair, if I could just clarify just that as far as we know now, those dollars can only be used for on-road diesel engines, not the off-road. I know there are some questions being asked of the court. We had a public comment period, and we'll see what the response to that is. But, you know, at this point, it needs to be focused on the on-road side of the equation.
But it's still a really long line of people that are interested.
Right. We have to make sure that we get the biggest bang for the buck with it.
I'm sorry if I missed it in your presentation. What's the schedule that the money will come in over?
Right. So
10 years.
No, Chair Edwards, the schedule is that, so the money is handled by a trustee to be identified, hired by the court. Volkswagen will make a payment of one-third of that amount of the $2.7 million, whatever that turns out to be, within, at the point at which the trust becomes effective. 12 months after that, there'll be another third payment, and then another year after that, the final third. So that the money, though, can be just expensed out over, or awarded out over a 10-year period of time.
By the state.
By the state, but it won't be received any faster than that three-year investment cycle.
Okay. Well, I've heard when the settlement was first announced, there was a lot of rejoicing because this is a sticky issue. And I think a number of stakeholders thought, wow, problem solved. And then came the line of, you know, at least to my door, or, you know, calls to my office that, hey, we're interested in buses, and we're interested in transit buses and school buses and off-road diesel and short haul. And what about port trucks and port moving equipment Yeah, exactly. The money just isn't going to cover all of that. So there's going to have to be some sort of list of principles before we get into just the process of getting votes in agreement to accept the money and spend the money.
And I will say before you get to his question that, you know, I mentioned that this settlement is fortuitous for the work that we've been doing with the diesel. In part because we have been talking about these principles of, you know, where the priorities should be. So we're actually much better positioned because we've initiated this conversation than our colleagues in other states who, you know, I've talked to some of them. They just really don't have a clue as to where they'll start this conversation.
Yeah. Senator Woodson.
Thank you. Can this money be used for CNG and LNG conversions?
Chair Edwards, Senator Woodson, yes. So the primary strategy that the court has outlined for trucks